Coming up on This Week in Google, it's me, Jason Howell, filling in for Leo Laporte. We've got Jeff Jarvis, Ant Pruitt, and our guest, Mike Elgin, joining from Marrakesh. We have a lot of fun on this episode. So many great stories. It's Google's 25th birthday, so we've got the good stuff that Google's remembered for. Then we talk a little bit about the bad stuff that Google's been remembered for, namely killing products. Speaking of products, we've got the Pixel event next week. In fact, before next week's episode, it happens in the morning, so you've got that to look forward to. We've got a little bit of a preview on what you can expect there. Meta had some announcements around VR and AR, and specifically, Mike Elgin is really excited about the new Ray-Bans. It's like an augmented reality kind of glasses product. I don't know. Maybe they can do it better than what Snap did with its spectacles. Antitrust trials aplenty. Of course, Google, which we've talked about, but also Amazon now in the crosshairs. And Tinder's best matches now behind a $500 paywall per month, by the way. All that and so much more coming up next on This Week in Google.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 735, recorded Wednesday, September 27th, 2023, outside of the nerdery. This episode of This Week in Google is brought to you by Discourse, the online home for your community. Discourse makes it easy to have meaningful conversations and collaborate anytime, anywhere. Visit discourse.org/twit to get 1 month free on all self-serve plans. And by Bitwarden. Get the open source password manager that can help you stay safe online. Get started with a free Teams or Enterprise plan trial, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. It's time for This Week in Google. I'm Jason Howell. I almost said This Week in Tech because who the heck knows why. Sometimes, you know, it's easy to get confused around here. At least it is for me. I'm filling in for Leo Laporte. Maybe that's part of the reason for my confusion. Maybe I feel like I'm not myself and I'm Leo today. We'll see how that plays out throughout the course of this episode. Always good to be here and good to welcome back Jeff Jarvis. How you doing, Jeff?
Hey. I just did a search on social media looking for some cheese porn from Leo and Lisa, and I'm disappointed to find none.
Because they are in Green Bay. Is tonight the game? No, tomorrow night is the big game.
Don't ask me. Ask Ant.
Yeah,
he knows better.
That's right. Ant Pruitt would know the answer to this. And yes, I mean, I already kind of know this, but you can go ahead and confirm, Ant. Tomorrow's the big game?
Yes. Yes. Tomorrow is the game. It's a Thursday night football, the Green Bay Packers and the Detroit Lions.
And the Detroit Lions.
Big day.
Is that a big game? That's a big divisional
rival.
Yeah.
Yes. Divisional rival. So we call it a good old fashioned hate fest, even though I know we're not supposed to say that, but.
But they are there. Lisa, Leo, and Michael, who is the big time Green Bay fan. Apparently,
he ran into Facebook. Aaron Jones. That's awesome. Ran into one of the players. That's awesome, Michael.
That's great. So he's having a great time. Michael's having a great time in Green Bay right now. And you know, the main event hasn't even started yet. The game is tomorrow. So he's got a lot to look forward to. Very cool trip. So we've all been kind of filling in for Leo while they've been gone. And you were on Security Now yesterday. I'm filling in, of course, here on This Week in Google and Micah on Windows Weekly.
I played the much richer toned voice and better looking version of Leo Laporte on Security Now.
There you go. You did a fantastic job, I have to say.
Speaking of cool trips, cool places to go. Oh, my Lord.
Indeed. Mm. Welcoming back Mike Elgin. Good to have you back, sir.
Yes. Great to be back. Thank you very much. You have Ant there as the expert in football. Me, an expert in cheese porn. So I know it when I see it. Let's just say that I know cheese porn.
I was just thinking, when you get back from these incredible gastronomad trips and a month in Marrakesh and you're eating amazing things because your wife knows everything about food and it's just phenomenal. What is your guilty secret junk food back in the States.
Super duper burger. Okay. And, it's a
burger.
Bay Area, burger fest. But I also, when we're in the US, we're at one of my son's house. So I have two sons. They both live on the West Coast. One is in Silicon Valley. He also has a daughter, my granddaughter. And so we tend to gravitate there because we want to see the granddaughter. And the granddaughter and I tend to make pizza. We make bread. We do all this stuff together. So that's the other thing is carb loading with, homemade bread.
There you go.
That doesn't, you make the pizza. No. If you'd said that you go out to Pizza Hut.
I caught that too, Jeff, by the way. It was like, well, that's sort of an answer.
I'd have more respect for you, Mike. I would. But no.
All I got is the super duper. That's all I got.
Yeah. Well, that's a good one to have. I mean, if you want to pick one, yeah, super duper doesn't get much better than their burgers. They do a pretty darn good cheeseburger.
It's extremely greasy.
And yes,
they have
it is.
Good beer as well.
It's full tilt, like greasy hamburger, cheeseburger. If you're really in the mood for something like that, you will not be disappointed. And you can get a container of pickles, which is really nice as well. Like a side thing of pickles. If you like those things. I love pickles personally. Should we start with the good news? Happy 25th birthday, Google. 25 years ago. And actually today, I think. Today is the day.
Today they're celebrating.
Yeah, they're celebrating.
This is the day.
Big time day. So
they have a special logo up there and I Easter eggs, which I haven't bothered to go look hunting for. But yes, this is a big day. It's a really big day. 25 years of Google is a big deal. It's had an incredible impact on the world. And I salute them for that.
Yep. And with it, the invention of PageRank, which Larry Page invented, which I remember when Alta Vista was the hot search engine and they just blew everybody away.
Yeah.
And they also did a lot of innovation in the data center realm when they were first launching, really interestingly. Instead of having big, powerful, expensive servers, they instead got a large number of flawed, underpowered, old PCs, whatever. And then they had software that could sort of route around all the hardware, the hard drive defects and all the other problems to have a cohesive, redundant data set that was very fast and low cost. So, the innovation wasn't just in finding stuff. It was in running a low cost, high performance data center. So,
Mike, to your first point, as I wrote in What Would Google Do? I have all my books handy to hold up.
Right? That book right there, Jeff, is that the book, What Will Google Do by Jeff Jarvis?
That was the book. Way back when.
Okay.
So PageRank also meant that they were respecting the actions and judgments of the public, right?
Yes.
The more people linked to this, they must have linked to it for a reason. Mm-hmm. More people linked to this person who linked to it, well, they must have linked to that person for a reason. And it was, it all got changed, obviously, as people manipulated this. And they had to hire people like Matt Cutts to stop the manipulation. But that essential assumption of the value of citation, which comes from an academic world, I think was a kind of wonderfully democratic view of the early internet. Rather than thinking like Yahoo did, we're going to hire a bunch of librarians to catalog the entire web and make judgment about it, which is kind of cute.
It's kind of old school versus new school thinking back then, the idea that Yahoo would kind of stick with the tried and tested, at least in the current paradigm of we'll just hire a bunch of people to make their assessments. And Google is like, well, why do you need to do that? We've got technology that can make those assessments for us and do it at a scale that we've never seen before.
Right. Yep. Remember when people used to think their website was broken? Go to google.com and they're like, where is it?
Where is it?
Yeah. Right.
I just watched a Today Show report on the 25th, and it was kind of, I didn't put it up because it was fluffy and dumb, but there was one person who worked for Google very early on in the first year who said people got scared by the empty box. Like, what do I do?
Yeah.
Which is very reminiscent of where they are today with ChatGPT. Like,
That's true. That's a really good kind of correlation there. You know what?
I remember a friend of mine had a little baby, and I was scared of babies, and I'd hold the baby and I'd say, Well, what do you want me to do?
What do I do now? Don't drop it. No. First rule of holding a baby, don't drop it. Did you, I didn't know this. Of course, you guys all knew this, but I didn't realize this, or maybe I've heard it at some point and it just didn't stick. I didn't know that it was originally called back rub. Google was originally called back rub. That's a factoid for me.
The business they originally ran to start was a pizza delivery business.
Really? Wow.
You've come a long way.
I think, wasn't it PageRank was originally called BackRub, or was it Google itself?
95, 96, at least according to this Reuters kind of like breakdown of notable moments. The very first one they list there is 95, 96. Page and Brin meet at Stanford University and create a search engine called or named BackRub. I don't know. Maybe they named that later BackRub. Maybe it became like a code.
It kind of makes sense, Mike.
That's a terrible name.
BackRub would be a metaphor, though, for PageRank early on, before they came up with a proper Larry Page joke.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah. It sounds like a metaphor for swapping links.
Right? Yes, totally.
Right.
Totally.
I'll rub your back if you rub mine, but that also gets a
little. Yeah.
That just kind of reminds me back then you had the, not the link farms, but they were like networks. They were like
page networks, or
whatever, where you go to a site and it would have the little badge down there as like member of blah, blah, blah. And they were all kind of like linking to each other.
Right. Chat room.
I don't remember that.
Because you're too young.
You're too young. Yeah.
I'm sure.
Oh, what did they call them?
But
that was the early sense of a network. In blogging, we did blog rolls.
Yeah, blog rolls.
But these were not link spiders.
Not link spiders. God, link something.
Circles. Oh, something. You're all too young.
Yeah, it's gonna.
I'm too old. Come up I forget.
At some point. That's but I remember, Web rings.
And a winner is
web rings.
Out of sync.
Got it.
Out of sync. Got it.
Yes. Web rings. That's right. I remember that. Which I mean, you know, when you think about it, you know, it's very similar kind of. Well, I guess maybe not exactly.
It's like a crime similar, ring,
but yes, right. It's like we're all part of the same gang.
It says they were popular in the 1990s and early 2000s.
They were. Yeah. Absolutely. That was how you discover
amateur websites.
You know, that was how I discovered a lot of things that I didn't know about. Like you could go to Yahoo and things were indexed and everything, but that was kind of a way to kind of get lost in the search or browsing experience and kind of just follow it where it goes instead of going to a destination and finding the place. It was more about exploration and stuff. Maybe that's off topic for what we're talking about.
The dumbest thing about the early web was that everyone bragged about the number of hits they got.
Yeah.
They have a live ticker on their page. I got 10,420 hits.
Oh, I bragged about that when I started.
That's all GeoCities right there. GeoCities.
Yeah.
We even did it at a newspaper company. We would tell the boss, look how many hits we got today. And it wasn't too long before we got set straight. That's stupid.
Exactly.
But,
that's right.
I did
a lot of bad tricks back then. I created a news feed right off the AP wire, which the AP hated that I did. And it refreshed every 30 seconds, which made sense because it would be new news. But we also
another
learned,
hit. Every-
that's a way to get more hits. And, more, and then as we advance, page views.
Yeah.
I think Drudge Report still does that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, the Washington Post did it for a while. Still might do it for a while.
Wow.
Those were the days, my
friend.
Those
are the things that are a lot simpler and a lot uglier on the web. Going to websites.
I put up a, I don't know if you have this, Jason, the things they killed.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's
many.
I think it's a wonderful,
bring us down, Mr.
wonderful
Jarvis.
Segue. Okay. So the point we're at right now is, hey, 25 years of Google. Here's all the great things Google says it did. And then here's all, you know, the other side of it is that Google kills a lot of things. Right. Android Police published kind of a look at 10 of at least their favorite products killed.
Yeah, I don't think they even included Reader.
Hey, are you serious?
Did they?
Let me see. I'm flipping through real quick.
10 is a small percentage.
Yeah, 10 is, yes.
You're right, Mike.
Go to killedbygoogle.com and you will see 10 is like but a sliver of the page. But you know, Google Now.
I saw the article and I just scrolled down to see that Google Plus was there. And I'm like, okay, Google Plus is there. I like the list.
Yeah, but I mean, Reader should really be here.
Reader should be on here.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Inbox. I miss Inbox.
I miss Inbox still.
No reason to kill it.
To this day.
I never did get down with Inbox.
Oh, man. I loved Inbox.
It took me a while, Ant. Yeah, understand.
Took me a while too.
Wisdom. But when you just give yourself over to the Google, it's a nice place.
The thing with Inbox, was it all about basically helping you better sort and file your email?
Yeah. Plus the UI was really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've incorporated a lot of that in the present Gmail, but why? It was a wonderful product. I don't understand them.
They've incorporated it, but it still just didn't quite. No. It doesn't quite replace. And I'm trying to think about how I can put my finger on exactly what's different. It just is. Yeah. And believe me, I've tried many years since Inbox. I've tried to get back to the point with Inbox. I didn't feel like I got buried by email, and I with Gmail, no matter what I do, I feel like I get buried by it.
You know, it's a real shame. And you know, Leo over time has complained about Google losing some mojo. The company is now better known for killing things than for starting things.
Yeah, indeed.
Which is really
right now, give them another couple of years, especially with this AI run that Google is on, with everything going on with Tensor and then the stuff that we're putting into the phones to try to springboard their phones back into popularity. So give them a couple of years.
I just think they're not as much of a consumer company as they used to be. Right. They used to start these popular consumer things, and Tensor is really important. You're absolutely right. And, and the transformer models that have led to so much of the AI work going on right now, the generative AI work going on is Google. Mm-hmm. And so as a corporation, far more profound than Inbox. I mean, no problem. I get that. But as a consumer, I'm disappointed.
Well, the problem isn't The problem is so much that they killed things is that they got their most active users really excited about certain things and then killed them. Yep. So great example of that is Google Plus or Google Reader or any of these things. These things had real fans.
Yeah.
And so it's just like Lucy with the football. Just again and again, those of us who want to be super fans of some of these products, we get all excited. We invest our time and energy into it. Remember Gina Trapani, who used to be on the show, wrote a book about Google Wave.
Right.
And then they killed it before the book was published, if I recall. I mean, that kind of thing where people invested a lot of themselves into these products and then they pulled the rug out. Meanwhile, the other biggest criticism of Google is that they didn't kill a lot of things. So, for example, their messaging strategy, they have, 12, 13 ways to message people, and nobody knows what's going on, and still they're all mutually quasi-incompatible. And if they had just done with the messaging that they did with email, in other words, pick one and throw everything at it, I think that that's a messaging platform is where you want to do that.
Can I do my rant now?
Right. Yeah.
Please do.
Google! You're pissing me off one more time. So last week we talked about extensions with Bard. So you could have it look at your email and do maps and do all these wonderful things. And Leo demonstrated it. And I thought, I can't wait. And while we're on the show, I'm texting. I wasn't tweeting, but I was texting with a customer support at Workspace or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
G-Spot, whatever it is. And
G-Suite.
Well, that's used to be what they call it. Now is it Workspace or Workplace? Workspace. Okay, right. So that's the other thing. Google, you and your damn brands. I went around and around and around there, and they keep on sending me, just standard script stuff. Well, look at this video about how Bard works. I know that. I said, it's embarrassing. I'm on a podcast about artificial intelligence and on a podcast about Google. I want to demonstrate this, and I'm not getting the icon on my Bard that would let me sign up for this. Well, you could also do the Google, the Bard elsewhere, which I did. And now when I look at web pages and I write stuff, it comes up with the stupidest stuff. For a while today, it was giving me Persian. And I said, why are you doing that, Bard? Well, you're using a Persian keyboard. No, I'm not. You're spying. Should know better than this. So I went around and around with three people at Workspace support. Three people with message after message where I just said, you're not listening to me. I know more about Google Bard than you do. There's an icon on the top of Bard that would let you do this stuff, and you're not giving it to me. And they never really admitted, finally, when it came out in the end, and they didn't even say it out loud, is, guess what? It doesn't work with my Workspace account.
Big surprise. Shocking.
I'm a paying customer, Google. I wrote a suck-up book about you, Google. I'm on a podcast about you, Google. I'm trying to look at your damn products and you won't let me. And that pisses me off.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Why don't you set up a burner account, Mr. Jarvis?
Here's the problem, man. I can look at what email is in that burner account.
Right.
Pure spam.
Yeah.
Gee, Google, why don't you search for prostate fixes? Right. How am I going to use it? Right.
Gosh.
It doesn't have my mapping history. It doesn't have nothing. It has nothing. Right. It's just a burner account. I can look. Oh, yeah, there's Bard. Okay. Useless. And the people who are paying them, and I went into all the admin things and I've turned on early features and I turned on, and that meant I turned on Bard and I can get to Bard in Workspace. They did turn that on, but then otherwise, F you, says Google. Well, thank you for that. I just needed to get that out of my system.
And so they didn't let Bard work for you because you have some weird stains on your fingertips. What the heck is that, Mr. Jarvis?
I voted.
He's an ink stained wretch. What do you mean?
I got to the bottom of my paperclip thing, and not me, but the
pins in there.
Leaked.
Yeah.
So I looked at that. Done that.
And now for the next couple of days, you're going to have to tell people why you have blue ink on your fingertips.
Well, I actually turned on the phone and did the reverse so I could look and make sure I hadn't done this with my face and put it on my face.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, we would have told you at the end of the show if you'd done that.
Yeah. We'll let you know if ink ends up on your face. at the end of the show.
Yeah. You don't want the Hitler mustache, right?
We'll make sure that doesn't happen. So, Jeff, here's the question that I have for you. I'm curious to know if you have the answer or if anyone here has the answer. Has Google given a reason as far as why they do keep doing this with their products? Keep releasing these features?
No, they never have. I think the reason is because, well, I mean, I'm the weird person. I'm just me. And I've got two old friends who are still on my account that I haven't seen in 15 years. That's it, right? Most of the accounts on Workspace are big corporate accounts that require management. And so they've got to think through the implications. If you're a company, so imagine the implications here. And I get this much. But this is why you have admins who control what users can do in Workspace. So imagine you're an accounting firm and an admin turns on, I should use my other hand since it's not blue, turns on Bard. For every user, and people start going into their confidential financial email, talking with Bard about it, that would be a problem. I get that. But if you're Google and you're planning to this product anyway, you should be thinking that much through, because these are the customers who are paying you and who care about it. And it's becoming less and less and less a B2C company and more a B2B company. And when it comes out with cool features, it should make them ready for prime time with the B2B customers.
Yeah, one would think.
But it doesn't.
I'm sorry, Jeff. It keeps happening. What about transferring? Like, can you transfer, like, 10 in IRC said, Jeff needs to Google how to transfer data from one Google account to another. Would that even work? Is that even something that you would be interested in?
I don't even know.
Because, like, it's not, does it do you any good to have the enterprise version of this anymore? Or was that at one time that made sense?
It's because my domain.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's why. Okay. And I do want to use Google products and I want to be on our AI show, AI Inside.
Yeah.
Thank you. And be able to talk knowledgeably about the products because I'm using
them. Yes, of course.
I can't, Google.
Of course.
So that's enough. I'll stop now. I'll stop.
No, it's okay. It's a rant that deserves to happen when it happens because it continues to be an issue.
Nonetheless, happy birthday, Google.
Happy birthday. You're still killing things. We didn't even mention the fact that they're killing another thing. Google did what it does best aside from ads. It's basically going to kill another product. Google Podcasts is on the chopping block. So if you are a user of Google Podcasts, this is kind of the argument that are you? Okay, because they rolled it out and I used it a handful of times and then I just continued using what I've always used, which is Pocket Casts for, probably because I'm just used to it. But is Google really getting rid of things that people aren't using? They're probably not just like throwing a dart on the wall, even though sometimes it feels like they are. And saying, oh, we'll just kill that thing then. There's probably good reason.
Well, they promote it enough to give it a fair chance. If you're in that product team, I could just imagine, I've been in magazines and newspapers that get killed because there's no promotion. I just had a degree program of mine paused. It's about marketing. And if you're not going to give the fair shake to it to get enough people to try it, then people are now, my son Jake is now, I'm not using anything from Google. Because they keep killing stuff. I mean, it's what Mike was saying. You get burned.
That trust is eroded for so many people who are really clued into this stuff. I know. I mean, it's the joke that automatically pops in my head anytime Google announces a new thing. And I know I'm not alone. I wonder how much that joke, you know, is for people who are kind of like outside of the following the day-to-day doings of a company like Google. Probably not very much. And so that's probably not why it doesn't matter as much to
people. At least in my experience, no one outside of the nerdery, tech geekery.
Right.
Even nerdery. Care.
Nerdery. I like that.
Nerdery. It's a place where you keep all the nerds, like a nunnery, but with nerds.
Nunnery. Yeah. I like that a lot. Yeah. There's no sex there either.
Another group of virgins. Exactly. But you know, actually podcast apps is one of the rare areas where the big companies like Apple and Google just can't compete with little independent apps. I mean, like, you mentioned Pocket Casts, Overcast, another one. There's a bunch of really great apps that are, you know, all the good independent apps are better than Apple's and Google's podcast apps.
You know, and what, Mike, you're right. That shames me, because the reason it can be like that is because of RSS, because of an open standard. Salute Dave Weiner, right?
Yes.
And that's the basis of podcasting. And so I shouldn't even be using Google Podcasts. I should be using one of those.
Yeah. I recommend Overcast. It's fantastic.
There's also YouTube podcasts, so like that's a competing.
Yeah, totally. And I think, and from my understanding, that's a big reason why this is even happening. You know, Google has, YouTube launched kind of a podcast functionality last year, but it didn't, you know, include anything around syndication and RSS. It was just like, if you're uploading your podcasts to YouTube, now we've got a place where you can find podcasts uploaded to YouTube. And then earlier this year, they kind of announced that they're going to accept, I don't know if they are yet, but going to accept syndicated RSS for YouTube. And then Google found itself probably in the place that it's found itself so many times because of all the competing different areas of Google where they're all working on similar things, but not the same thing that's unified, where they said, okay, wait a minute, we've got two different products that basically want to do the same thing. They probably, and I think you're exactly right, Jeff, it comes down to marketing, right? YouTube increasingly becomes Google's kind of like media destination. It's kind of surprising that they didn't do this from the beginning.
Yeah.
But there you go. It kind of makes sense.
Google's a big, big, big company. Eric Schmidt always said back in the day that would be its biggest challenge, is size.
Mm-hmm.
Its biggest benefit, but also its biggest challenge. And I can imagine somebody in YouTube sitting there, an executive in YouTube, and I'm making this up out of thin air, but you can just imagine the scenario where somebody comes and says, we should have a podcast thing. Oh, no, we're doing a podcast. We're not doing that. And so somebody gets off and they do a product, and they say, okay, we'll do a separate product and prove that it works. And then YouTube says, okay,
wait a minute. Spotify brought podcasts into their network. That seems to be going okay for them. We should do that too.
So God knows what the politics are.
And I got Spotify Mindshare. It's on the Spotify Mindshare podcast sort of makes sense for them. Most people don't think podcasts when they think Google. I think they would think podcasts more so when they hear YouTube. You know what I'm saying? That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
and you got to give Google credit for, as much as it pains us that they kill off things that we enjoy, but at least they're trimming the fat and trying to look somewhat like a properly managed company.
I still think they need an executive like Marissa Meyer, who cared about consumer products. And you know, again, that's just that's not what the company wants to be now, it appears, but
no.
It's got a lot of consumers.
Yeah.
And they're giving up opportunities there, I think, that especially in this time when they're in an antitrust case and people are going after them, to be more popular with the users would not be a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, and meanwhile, we're saying this about, you know, consumer products in the essentially on the eve, not quite the eve, but as far as this show is concerned, the eve of their next Made by Google event, which happens next Wednesday, so a week from today in the morning. So definitely next week's This Week in Google, you guys are going to be talking about the hardware announcements and everything coming from there.
Even though we probably will know everything beforehand.
We already know what they're going to talk about.
We know. But before we get into that stuff, does either of you, are we confident that Google is all in on hardware at this point? You know what I mean? Like, we're talking about this lack of trust from Google.
We just had a discussion about killing Google stuff.
This is exactly why I ask it, because here we are 8 years into the Pixel experience or whatever, experiment, whatever you want to call it.
Mr. Howard, you shouldn't have set it up that way.
I'm just saying. Like, okay, great. They've got another, you know, series of hardware that they're going to announce, but... like, there's a part of me that wouldn't be surprised if in a year or two, they're like, okay, yeah, we want to leave it to the people who know hardware best, you know, the people who use our products.
Well, they did it with the Chromebooks. My other rant. I miss my Chromebooks from Google.
Yeah. Chromebooks are still ticking, too. They're still kicking.
What do you think, Mike? Well, I'm curious Google to hear Chromebooks. Your perspective on this.
Well, like Jeff, I had a Chromebook, I had a Pixelbook for a long time and loved it. And one of the reasons I got it and enjoyed it was that using the internet, using lots of extensions and so on through Chrome was very fast on the Pixelbook. It was the fastest experience I was aware of until Apple Silicon came out on MacBook Pros, which just blew them out of the water. I mean, way more expensive, but a MacBook, the MacBook Pro I have now is an amazing Chromebook and Chromebook extension platform, and so I'm much happier with that. But it was such a durable machine, so light and thin and elegant. I actually thought industrial design was more elegant than Apple's products by far. I just thought it beautiful, and I tend to use things for 2 or 3 years. And then I break them especially if it has a keyboard, I will destroy it because I'm just like pounding on those keys like all day long, every day. And this freaking thing never had the slightest problem. I kept waiting for it to have a problem so I'd have an excuse to upgrade to something else. Keyboard was flawless. The screen was perfect. Everything was perfect and it never sort of aged. The battery, you know, declined a bit, but what a fantastic device that was.
You're right. Mm-hmm. My Pixelbook Go, on the other hand, which is the last Google product here. Yeah.
Not as magical.
The touch screen no longer touches and the microphone doesn't work.
Oh.
And yeah. So I'm waiting for the new, what's that, Jason, what's the new high end category of Pixelbooks they announced? Pixelbook, not X, but something like that.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
So I'm waiting for that to come out.
The premium
kind
of Chromebook experience. What was that called?
Yeah, premium specifications.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
I can't remember that. I always think of Samsung when I think of premium ones, premium Chromebooks.
I think that's the framework one you're thinking about.
No, it was
a Google specification.
It was like an effort. Yeah. It was a Google effort to like harness, you know, higher end, higher performance Chromebooks. Probably a handful of months ago they mentioned it.
Chromebook X. That's it. Chromebook X.
Was that it? Chromebook X? Okay. Yeah. And who knows where that's at now? Can't even search for it.
We can't even remember it.
I mean, that is a big problem. Google's got so many different, it's gigantic. So any of these things, it's really, really
kind
hard
of a turd of a name after developments on Twitter.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, no kidding, right? That's a really good point. I wonder if that deters anybody.
Because of Russia. So let's start over again. Chromebook A.
Yeah. I would say that I give them... I would trust them more so on the phone side of things.
Yeah.
It seems like the Chromebook side of things, they could just sort of let Samsung jump in and do what they're doing because Samsung is so big and do a really good job with their Chromebooks. But I could see Google making a serious effort with the phones now, especially again, like I mentioned earlier, with the chipsets and owning that stack themselves,
Yeah, doing Tensor in the phone so you can do AI locally. I think the need to demonstrate is still there.
Yeah,
And let's go back.
And granted, they need to market it the way Apple markets the crap out of their stuff. You know, that nobody talks about the Pixel stuff because they never see it, in my opinion. Yeah.
Well, I feel like I've heard over the last handful of years, some real awareness from non-Android users that Pixels have great cameras. Yes.
Oh, okay.
I've definitely heard from people who are iPhone, you know, users who are like, well, but you know, the Pixel's got an excellent camera. The camera quality is up there. More awareness around that than I'm used to hearing from non-Android users.
There should be, there used to be a reason why Google had came out with phones and tablets. Back in the day, their first lines of phones were like reference models, right? To sort of lead the way and Nexus. Show, and they were open. The Nexus, right. They were open. You could tinker with them. You could mess around with them. And it was basically this sort of nerd tool so that everybody could understand and embrace the platform better than whatever came out of Asia, right? From South Korea and China. And then when they came out with the Pixelbook, well, you know, all the Chromebooks were kind of low end, kind of crappy. And they came out with a premium high end Chromebook. That was the reason for that. And now there are premium high end Chromebooks. And you have to assume that the new X specification is a way to goad other manufacturers into doing the high-end laptops so that Google doesn't have to anymore. But where's the vision? Like, what's the reason for hardware? You know, Google should have a good reason. And one of the things they should be doing, and I think we're going to be talking about the Meta Ray-Ban specs pretty soon. That's an innovative category that Google's letting Facebook or Meta run away with. Another category that I'd love to see.
I mean, they're smart to do that, Mike.
The Android watches category is in kind of endless trouble because the Apple Watch is so dominant. But I'd love to see Google come out with something really visionary with for the wrist platform. For example, something that's just pure voice AI on the wrist or something like that. I'd love to see them lead the way in some way. If they're just going to be another OEM for hardware that's in the same ballpark, has a pretty good camera in their phones, for example, it's not worth doing for a company like Google, I wouldn't think.
Yeah. We will see next week what Google does and whether Ant approves.
Let's also, I
think Google was very smart with the phones. Apple was ahead, obviously. They invented the whole field.
Right.
Google purchased Android, made it open, and that was the strategy. That they were going to be open and generally were, and it was a really, really smart strategy, an international strategy.
Oh, for sure. The scale, unbelievable scale, the way that they did it. And I should also go just take a step back and just affirm, like, I don't actually believe that Google's going to kill the Pixel lineup. I just don't. I just think the more that I see Google be uncertain about the steps it takes in so many different facets of its business, the less I'd be surprised if it happened. And I think that's saying something about a company like Google.
We can't count on Google.
Yeah, totally.
To Google's credit, they haven't done any less than the Nexus line. We got up to what, the Nexus 6P or what was it?
The Nexus 7 was a tablet.
The 7 was a tablet.
Yeah, you're right.
I think it was like a 6P.
And then they probably, the 6P was the Huawei.
And then it sort of went away, you know. And now we're on this Google Pixel line, and we're up to 8 as of next week. Yeah. So they've at least exceeded the previous models.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I think Pixel has been, you know, a pretty interesting story to follow for Google throughout the years. And like, the camera has been a big success. The design changes in the last couple of years were very polarizing, I think, in the beginning. And now I think, we've just kind of like, I think it was smart, you know, that phone looks nothing like any other phone from the back, you know, that weird bar on the back, and people have gotten used to it. The 8 and the 8 Pro going to look very similar in many ways. I think, you know, some of the design changes, not even really worth mentioning, kind of more rounded corners throughout and stuff like that. But I think what's interesting about what the rumors are around the 8 and the 8 Pro is that they're up. The rumors say that Google is updating or changing the update cycle, or rather the update promise for these devices, to give them the best that Android has, 7 years of updates. So that would be a promise of 3/4 of a decade, which is a lot for Android devices.
That's awesome.
And awesome. I don't know how that's, the rumors don't mention how that breaks down, like how many major OS updates, how many security, how many feature drops, like what is the breakdown of that? But when we're talking about, you know, iOS devices, iPhone devices, they're updated for as long. I mean, that seems to take this phone almost to where Apple has been with its phones, which that's an impressive feat. I'm not sure that I expected that, and especially not with the upcoming 8. So I think that's a good deal. And then, of course, we'll see the Pixel Watch 2. Google, you know, this is basically, we're a week out from the event, which means leaks aplenty. And who knows how many of them are courtesy of Google itself and how many of them actually.
I saw one of your articles in the rundown pretty much mentioned in there. Yeah, these are leaks, but then some are straight out from Google too.
Oh, so. Yeah. You have to imagine. It's part of their strategy. So
what was the last iPhone for which people lined up overnight?
I don't know.
It's like six or so, maybe
the four. I don't know.
Yeah. I think it was the excited about.
When Steve, I remember the last time I waited outside for an iPhone was right after Steve Jobs had died. What was that? 2010, something like that.
Yeah, around there.
And I think that was the iPhone 4, maybe.
It was 2011.
Okay. So that makes sense. The iPhone 4 launch, and we're out there all night. I was sitting next to Steve Wozniak in Los Gatos. It was very cool.
Wow.
And that event was combined with flowers and little portraits, like the outflowing of tributes to Steve Jobs. Since then, I don't think there's been a major people lining up, has there?
Yeah, Yeah, there are some articles for the iPhone 15. Global debut marked by long lines, but you know it's not like it was.
Yeah.
I don't know that people are camping out for 24, 36 hours. Yeah, what do you classify?
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's also marked by people smashing the window and running in and grabbing up all the iPhones and running.
Mm. Yeah, there's that.
Did that happen with this?
Most of the lines that you see are usually for appointments, not necessarily. We're hoping we can get in to get a phone. Aren't people going out there now because they already have an appointment and a guaranteed piece of hardware when they get there?
Yes. For the 15, people ordered it early, and the people who did order it on the first day could pick it up on the 22nd. Right, of September, and that at a certain time, and so they arrived a couple hours before that time and lined up. So yeah, it's a line, but it wasn't in the old days. People were lining up because they didn't want to not get one. Right, They figured there was limited. Now they're guaranteed one. And they just have to do a store pickup. So it's a very different.
That's what I thought.
It was kind of a party line too. Like everybody that was in that line was super excited to be in that line because, you know, they were all there because they were all equally as passionate about this. And
Well, the impressive thing about iPhones, of course, is that people buy them sight unseen without a single review, without a single hands-on review. They'll order one and they cost a fortune. Mm-hmm. I got an iPhone. It's the lowest end model and it was $1,000 at the end of the day.
Mm.
Yeah. So, you know, it's amazing that they can do that still.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Pixel lineup, not quite there yet. I don't know if it ever will be, but
still $1,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
Insert Ant's rant.
I didn't see that.
Again, I'm rooting for them. I just wish Google would be honest and stop overpricing these things. But I root for them to be successful. But you don't have to charge $1,200 for a phone.
Well, I think Google should have the most expensive phone because, again, back in the day, they were pushing the envelope. You know, they had the most expensive Chromebook, for example, in the beginning of the Pixel Book. There was a good reason for that because other manufacturers were not doing high-end, powerful Chromebooks. So they said, here's a super high-end, elegant, powerful Chromebook. Yeah, it cost $1,200 or whatever it was, and it was too expensive. I'd love to see them do a leapfrog of some kind, like a leapfrog in the photography, not just have one of the good cameras, not just have one of the good phones in the Android space, But they should be, they should say, where should phones be in 5 years, and make that phone now and charge $2,000 for it.
Well, they're kind of doing that with the foldables, which very few people are going to buy, but they're showing what's possible.
But but are they ahead of Samsung? I don't think so. No. I think they're foldables.
Yeah, I mean, they did just release their very first, you know, foldable, which, yeah, absolutely, they are not ahead of Samsung. Samsung's too, has grown so much through its last 5 years of foldable experimentation. They're at a point
and
now
all
where
the criticism from all of us, and they've learned from that criticism, for and it just got better.
Jason, since you're still the king of Android to me.
Oh, thank you.
If you were going to project 5 years ahead, what market share do you think foldables would have versus
That's a really good question. I don't know that I necessarily think that foldables are the thing that 5 years from now everybody's going to have in their pocket. I think it's still kind of a niche market, in my opinion. I just don't think it's necessary. I think right now, based on what we've seen, I'm not convinced that it is the everybody must have it, you know, in the future, and that market share increases exponentially as a result. I just don't see it. It's neat.
And what we we don't know about foldables is how long do they last?
Well, that's true.
Right? They're too new.
Yeah, the wear could be awful. Yep. I put in the rundown at the bottom of the rundown a foldable laptop.
The display is
already fold. Don't they already fold?
Screen folds. The screen folds.
That's the thing. It's screen on screen.
Right. So the screen kind of folds in on itself. Yeah. So then you've got a seamless here. I'm about to pull up the article.
I need to see this. Where is this?
Yeah. Okay. So it's like one seamless display.
Yes. Exactly.
That folds on itself, similar to foldables, foldable phones. Yeah. 17 inch LG foldable OLED. Okay. So 4.99 million won. That's around roughly $3,726. Just conversion.
For which you get a giant screen, which you can carry around, but you need a keyboard.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing about this, though, is like if it's all display and there's no keyboard on the inside, then I'm using a virtual tap screen keyboard. And I'm sorry, like just not
you lost me there.
I don't want that. I want the tactile. Maybe I'm old school. In that regard, but because I don't.
You're an old fart now, Jason.
I mean, I've done the thing with the tablet where it's like a full screen, and I pull up the keyboard that's almost the same size as a real keyboard, and tried to use it. It's just not the same. No, like you know what? It's just not.
Yeah,
that would be miserable to me. So, but neat.
I think the future of laptops is. If not a foldable screen, a two screen thing with a virtual keyboard, simply because younger people, not us old journalists who just can't not type on a keyboard.
Yeah, right.
But younger people who are going to be using a combination of voice, gestures, AI, all these other things, where the actual typing part is not as important as the tons and tons of screen real estate part. So I think it's generational shift there at some point. They're not going to change our minds, but I think people who are in their 20s right now may prefer a smaller device with a bigger screen and opt to give up the keyboard, just like everybody did with phones, right?
Yeah, right.
There was a time in 2006, 2007 where people were like, nah, I can't even imagine not having my BlackBerry keyboard, right?
That's true.
And of course, they won us all over, and now we all use, happily, I guess, on-screen keyboards, and we never think about physical keyboards on a phone. It's a ridiculous concept. So we'll see where that goes. But I also think we're going to see a big shift in the importance of if not phones, at least with laptops, when we have, when we have augmented reality laptops. And so, I a lot of people are not thinking along those lines. They don't think of it as a replacement for a laptop. But I do think that in 3, 4, 5 years, we definitely will be thinking about AR as a replacement for a laptop. We just have a little flat thing with a keyboard on it, and then the screen is this gigantic thing. Well, it's I think it'll be a generational thing. I mean, look at that big, beautiful office you have. tons of room for a big display. Whereas I'd like to have a big display as a traveler, right? And a virtual display is really appealing to me. So I think that, and again, I'm not saying it's going to replace laptops. I think that it'll replace a two-digit percentage of laptops for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let me pull. So I know what you're going to say. So Google, as you said, Google is leaving behind pretty much VR. Zuck is betting the company on it still. What do the other two think? Who's the smarter one?
There's that Israeli company. I'm calling it up now. Let me see. It's called they call it the augmented reality PC. Let's see. Where is it?
While you look,
Sightful is a company that is basically doing what I think Google should have done with the Chromebook line or with the Pixelbook line, which is that they have a base. So the Sightful spacetop device is what they call an AR laptop. So basically what it is it's the bottom half of a laptop and then there are goggles you put on and you see a 100-inch screen in augmented reality.
Yeah,
and
Zuckerberg showed how he was fast typing without the keyboard, just on a virtual keyboard.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
But I don't think it's going to take off.
But the Sightful has a physical keyboard and a virtual screen. And the thing about the Sightful is, like the Chromebook, it's a cloud device. So it's very inexpensive, actually. It's much cheaper than your average laptop. And it has a 100-inch display. And so I don't think that Sightful necessarily will be the winner there, but I think that companies like Google could really make a big dent with this kind of thing. And I think that this is where the whole thing with anything mobile or portable is you want to maximize screen real estate and minimize the size of the hardware, right? So this is just a brilliant way to just shatter that whole conundrum by just having a tiny little lightweight, low cost device with a 100-inch display that's virtual. I just think there's something to it.
I still want to hear Jason, do you think?
Do I think what?
You think that's the future, that we're going to be, that's how we're going to do it?
I still say no because of cost. And we still have this weird mixed world of hybrid work, that being a concern. So people are not going to necessarily want to invest into stuff like this in the big workspace because there's people still fighting to be at home. I don't see it yet.
Jason, do you have the Sightful video? I thought I saw that.
That Sightful looked pretty cool though. I dig that more so than the Vision stuff that I just saw. Apple.
I don't have my laptop streaming into the TriCaster, but I believe Benito has the site or was showing the site.
Well, showing the site.
And if so, I guess that video would be on the site. Do I think that this is coming at some point? Maybe. Yes. I mean, I do think that there will be a small percentage of people that will love and enjoy working in this direction. Yeah. I don't know that I'm sold that that's going to be the majority of people, but maybe I'm not looking far enough down into the future, you know, as far as that's concerned.
The glasses are unsightly.
Yeah, the glasses are a little bug-like.
I take those glasses more than those goggles.
Yeah.
I think the wild card is the Apple Vision Pro.
Yes.
Apple is a way of mainstreaming things. And again, I don't think they're going to mainstream it next year. It's going to be for developers and, you know, but give it 2-3 years with Apple hammering away at this thing. I think the concept of a virtual display is going to seem a lot more appealing to a lot more people than it does now.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Apple just has that way with them when it comes to a new product category. And I mean, I'm super curious to see the Apple Vision Pro and to see kind of what sets it apart and to kind of get a better understanding of the pixie dust that Apple is able to sprinkle onto it, how it integrates with, you know, the other devices that you're already using. And but I think, you know, right now, based on what we've seen, it's still kind of cumbersome, at least compared to what we already accept as, you know, like a laptop is not cumbersome, but it's something that we accept because that's the way it's been, you know. So there's a little bit of a hurdle there. There's the sick kind of like detached from reality thing that a lot of people experience.
The creepy eyes.
It's not perfect. Yeah, the creepy,
yeah, the creepy eyes on the outside of the display. The uncanny valley of the of the avatars and so on. They got a lot to work through.
There's a lot to work.
But I just think there's something to it, and I don't know where it's really going to go. But I think that it's, I think that that's going to have more legs than the folding screen idea for maximizing.
Mm-hmm. Is it going to come down to a killer app, though? Like, it always comes down to a killer app.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's a good question.
Like Steve Jobs there.
What is the killer app for VR as it exists right now? I was going to wait until
it's not like, it's video games, but like, it's not like,
but that's,
Personally, I've been predicting that the killer app for augmented reality is virtual meetings to replace Zoom. So instead of looking at a Brady Bunch screen of people where there's 20 people looking at you throughout the entire meeting, no matter who's talking, you'll have virtual avatars scattered around the room, and you'll be able to make eye contact with their avatar. They're going to make eye contact with your avatar, and you're going to have conversation like that. I think that's going to be, lots of people push back on that and say, no way, that's, I don't like that. But I think avatar based, holographic avatar based meetings is one of the killer apps for augmented reality.
What's the pushback on that, Mr. Elgin?
Well, people just don't like the idea of avatars because we've never seen a good avatar. Yeah. So you have like Memoji, which are like goofy, cartoony things that look ridiculous and not really acceptable for business meetings. Yeah. And then you see the thing that Apple demonstrated in their rollout of the Vision Pro, which is like this creepy, like uncanny valley, too close to real but not quite real kind of thing. That's unacceptable. So we haven't seen a good avatar, but if somebody can figure out how to have an avatar that's the right balance of realism without being too real and without being too cartoonish, I think it'll be much more appealing for people to use. We just haven't seen it. Nobody has done it. Facebook's avatars are not terrible. Some of the ones that they've rolled out, but a lot have tried, nobody's succeeded, but I gotta think that somebody at some point is going to come out with a good way to do avatars.
Well, I lag in our Discord with the great analogy here. The airplane isn't an improved bird. VR meetings aren't improved for meetings, for virtual meetings.
I don't like the idea of VR meetings, but AR meetings, I think people will like to have because they showed two versions at the Apple event. One was you had these boxes where the talking head avatar was inside the box. Yeah. Then when they got together later in the week to talk to developers, they said, okay, the version right after that is just a holograph floating in space without the box. And so it's like you're talking about life-size people that are vaguely photorealistic that you can make eye contact with. The sound comes from their hologram and all that kind of stuff. That's the kind of thing that the public hasn't been shown yet. And again, I don't think it's ready for prime time because of the uncanny valley problem. Mm-hmm. But that doing it in AR, where you see your whole room, you see your old office, you see your actual surroundings with hologram, like the, you know, it's like the Haunted Mansion, right? You have like these semi-transparent holograms floating in space. I think that's way more appealing than VR.
Well, let's take a break, because I just realized we are now an hour into this show because these topics are fascinating and we got some amazing people talking about this stuff. I'm having a great time. And when that happens, time flies by quick. When we come back from the break, we can maybe touch in a little bit on the meta news, because there's meta news tying into exactly, you know, some of the topics that we're talking about right now. Got a little bit about antitrust on Google's side, on Amazon's side. We've got a whole lot more to talk about coming up. Mike Elgin, so great to have you here. Thank you for joining me again today. And of course, Ann Pruitt from his home studio, looking so sharp. We can count the number of hairs on his chin. That's right. The camera always looks good. And then Jeff Jarvis, always great to get to do a show with you, Jeff. Thank you. We want to take a break, though, and thank the sponsor this week in Google. This is brought to you by Discourse, the online home for your community. More than a decade is how long Discourse has really made it their mission to make the internet a better place, to connect people through the use of online communities by harnessing the power of discussion, real-time chat, And yes, you guessed it, AI. Discourse makes it easy to have meaningful conversations and collaborate with your community anytime, anywhere. We actually have a Discourse community, twit.community. And yeah, it's just, it's fantastic. It's another avenue, another way for people to connect with each other and, you know, with fans of the Twit Network, also, you know, with the people creating the shows. It's just awesome. If you'd like to create a community, you can visit discourse.org/twit. Make sure and go there. That, you know, of course, lets them know that you heard about it through us, but you'll also get 1 month free on all self-serve plans. Trusted by some of the largest companies in the world, Discourse is open source. It powers more than 20,000 online communities. So whether you're just starting out or you want to take your community that you already have to the next level, well, there's a plan waiting for you. There's the basic plan. That's for private invite-only communities. A standard plan if you want unlimited members and a public presence. And then, you know, even further than that, there's a business plan for active customer support communities. Jonathan Balava is the developer advocacy lead at Twitch. Jonathan says, Discourse is the most amazing thing we've ever used. We've never experienced software so reliable ever. Reliability, you really need that when you're talking about a community of the size that we're talking about when we're talking about Twitch. One of the biggest advantages to creating your own community with Discourse is that you own your own data. It's your data. You'll always have access to all of your conversation history. Discourse will never sell your data to advertisers. So that's some peace of mind for you as well. Discourse gives you everything you need all in one place. So you can make Discourse the online home for your community. Visit discourse.org/twit. Again, go there to that URL, discourse.org/twit. You'll get 1 month free on all self-serve plans. That's discourse.org/twit. And we thank Discourse for their support of This Week in Google. Okay. So we were talking a little bit about AR, about VR, and kind of talking a little bit about Meta, because I think when I think of kind of modern VR, and, you know, it looks like AR is becoming a bigger kind of part of Meta's business with this new announcement. But when I think of modern VR, they're the big, you know, shining example of it in the room. Notably, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, has focused the company that was once known as Facebook onto the metaverse by naming it Meta. Yeah. And I don't know, is the jury still out, or have we decided that that was a poor move, poorly timed move on Mark's part? I mean, I don't know. It feels like the metaverse is a couple of years hype ago. And not now, well, hype, but maybe we aren't to the point at which he envisioned.
Well, my beef with the whole thing was that the metaverse was a word from fiction, and yeah, it always was a dystopian nightmare, mm-hmm, always a bad thing. He dusted it off. It was I looked at the Ngram viewer over the decades, so since the 80s or 90s, whenever it peaked out, and it had declined in usage in the English language to less than half of where it was. It was a dying word. And then he resurrected it. And the press, the tech press, bought it hook, line, and sinker. Clearly, the use of metaverse was designed to go hand in hand with the renaming of the company to Meta. Right. Yeah. So that it appeared that they were like the future of VR/AR. And then he rolled out this vision of saying, okay, it's going to be the AR VR version of the internet. One space for everything and everyone, open. Nobody's going to own it. Meta's not going to own it. And then as soon as he said that, everybody forgot that he said that. And now every little two-bit third-rate VR thing is a metaverse play, right? I don't understand why everybody followed his lead into the use of the word metaverse, but everybody did. Most commentators did, in fact, follow him, and he got away with it. So I guess it's kind of a brilliant move on his part.
Yeah, right.
It's the same way Apple made everybody say a tablet is not a tablet, it's an iPad.
Yeah, right. Or a podcast is named after the iPod.
Yeah. So so today, I guess there has been the Meta Connect event where a lot of their kind of next initiatives for the company are announced, and we're, you know, often presented or given some insight into the next hardware. And this announcement was no different. We got the MetaQuest 3 being announced, a new headset, $499, October 10th. Improvements include a higher res display. So it features a dual 2064x2208 pixel display. That compares to 1832x1920. So a notable
Google Glass
improvement. What's that, Jeff? I missed that.
And they laughed at Google Glass.
Google, I mean, this is a highly different product from what Google Glass ever was.
Yeah, the difference there, Mr. Jarvis, is people are staying at home with these, not Google Glass.
They're not embarrassing themselves in public.
Well, maybe they will, because this is a mixed reality headset. This includes two outward-facing color cameras, like on the Quest Pro. So they call it the first mainstream headset built for mixed reality. I don't know that that necessarily means you're going to see people walking out and about, you know, on the streets with a MetaQuest 3. But
and of course, that is Addie Someday. Robinson. I recognize the lower half of her face.
Yes, indeed. She's talented with this stuff. I always love talking to her about the new VR hardware that she's testing.
Yeah, and I have no problem with the fact that, of course, VR headsets are going to be as bulky. You know, the weight is a bigger problem than the ugliness of them and the size. But that's no problem. The problem is that people don't want to live in VR for hours and hours and hours. And that was part of the original vision of the metaverse. It was just like, you'll get up, it'll be like Ready Player One.
Yeah.
You get up in the morning, you put them on, you go to school, you go to work, you do all this. And it's like, nobody wants that. And
That kind of sounds like a nightmare to me.
Yes,
but
they did come out with their camera glasses, which is to me a much more interesting.
So you're talking about the Meta Ray-Ban. Are these the camera glasses?
Yep. Because,
okay. So you mentioned this earlier. You probably know a little bit more about these smart glasses than I do, because I haven't had a chance to read up on these. What are they?
Well, they already have a version of these. I forgot what they're called, but they retired the branding on that. And like you say, these are called the Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses. These are a vast improvement. So what they have is they have two cameras in them. They cost $300. And the idea is that you can talk on the phone. They have supposedly have really good sound. They have, you can live stream to Facebook or Instagram through the glasses, which is going to be really a big deal. I think a lot of people are going to be live streaming through these things. And then when people comment during the live stream, their comments will be spoken to you audibly, while you're wearing the glasses. So you can be interacting with your audience as you're live streaming. So that's a really interesting development to me. Their microphones are way better than the other ones. The other ones had one mic. These have five mics, including one in the nose bridge. And so hopefully they have gotten to the point where the audio quality in both directions, going out and coming in, are going to be much better. The cameras are 12 megapixel cameras, and they do take 1080p videos. And I just think this is a great product. I'm totally getting it. I wrote a piece about this a couple months ago based on the rumors of this product. And one of the things that I miss about Google Glass is the ability to take pictures from my face. Mm-hmm. Because I think I always felt like that's an actual distinct medium that gives you the actual view of what you see better than anything else, better than smartphone camera and stuff. So I'm looking forward to buying and using these, actually.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, that was my absolute favorite quality of Google Glass, was that you could record video from your perspective or take a photo from your perspective. That was nice. But recording video, I mean, I recorded my second daughter's first steps wearing Google Glass, and I can go back to that video and watch her walking towards me. And it gives me chills thinking about it, because it takes me back to that memory, because that's exactly how I remembered seeing it. And,
I remember your video of that event. So this is like, this is a great medium, right? This is a great medium. And I'm glad that, you know, I think these glasses will be a lot more socially acceptable. And I don't know, I didn't see the announcement, but I know that, the leaks, indicated that it has a light on it that shows when it's recording. And if you put tape over the light or you disable the light in any way, it won't record.
Nice.
Again, don't quote me on that. That's that, nice. That information comes from Peak. But I think that's an interesting attempt by Meta to make them more socially acceptable so that people know when you are and are not recording.
Yeah, when you're recording, according to the Verge article, a white light around the lens pulses to indicate you're recording. So, yeah. Yeah, I think that's important. I mean, I think you have to have that on a something like this. Otherwise, you're begging for trouble. You're begging for pushback at this point. That's for sure.
But this does open a can of worms, though, right? Because even if Meta does this, some other whatever Chinese company or something is just going to make the same thing that doesn't tell you when it's recording.
Yeah, if they're not already. Yeah, or if they haven't already.
If this becomes like a consumer product. Yeah, exactly. But if it becomes like a regular product that everybody has.
Yeah.
Then that becomes a problem. No?
Those are going to exist too.
You could buy a lapel pin camera now. You can
Yeah, but I'm saying, but if this becomes like a regular consumer object that everybody actually has, then everybody is going to be doing that.
Mm. Yep.
And that's a problem, isn't it?
It's
Google Glass too, though. I mean, it was.
And
it was,
where's Google Glass now?
New York Times columnist.
It's a technical difference from the reality that we all live in, which is that people are recording video and pictures with their cell phone cameras everywhere all the time.
Yep.
And we're in them. Like, you know, you go to a restaurant and somebody's going to take your picture, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to take a picture of the food and the restaurant and the room and all that stuff. And you're going to be in it. And then something like Facebook or Google Photos is going to recognize your face. And it's like, we already live in that world.
Yes.
And to put the camera from here on my phone to here on my glasses, really not that much of a difference.
It makes a difference when you're talking about stuff like the bathroom.
Mm-hmm. But see, wait. I had this argument with a New York Times columnist who complained about Scoble going to the bathroom. I said, nobody wants a picture of your junk. No.
There are people.
You know, we deal with that with society. We we'll deal with it here. I just don't think that's going to happen.
I do think it's a reasonable prediction to predict that people, if this gets popular, the Facebook specific product becomes as popular as they hope it will, that they will be blamed for this problem of invasion of privacy, even though, as we suggested, they're trying to be the more responsible party and have the blinking light. It reminds me of the Apple AirTags, where people are notified that there's an AirTag with them, and they discover that somebody planted an AirTag in their car, and then people are like, "Oh, Apple, you're evil because you're doing it." No, actually, Apple's the one that's telling people that there's a million different cheap third-rate 2-bit trackers that you can buy on the internet for very low price, and they've existed for decades. But Apple's the one that came along and starts notifying people when they're tracking you. So, you know, I think all a company like Meta can do is have the blinking light and try to be responsible about notifying others in the room that you're recording.
Yeah.
Yeah. We renegotiate our norms around these new things. We will.
Yeah. Cover their tracks.
And if you have a friend who comes into the bathroom and does this, they're not your friend anymore.
If they come into the bathroom and their glasses are blinking, you need to cover more than your tracks.
That's true. That's true. But I don't think anyone, like, I guess I push back a little bit, Jeff, on the everybody will get used to it. It's not going to be a big deal. Because if I was to go into a bathroom with like a full camera setup, like a blatant full camera setup, and go into the bathroom and there's somebody else in there, I think people would get pretty pissed.
Well, they're telling you not to do it. It's just like in gyms, people said, don't take your camera, your phone, into the bathroom, into the changing room.
Yeah.
That became the norm. That became the what we renegotiated around this, because phones suddenly had cameras. And so things changed. And we'll do the same thing. And we'll figure it out. We're, we're okay. We've gotten through wars and pestilence. We'll figure it out.
I think the other side of that, though, is that these glasses like these, like we're finally kind of getting to the point where smart glasses actually don't look like pieces of technology as much as they used to. They used to look blatantly like technology on your face. And now they're starting to get to the point where these things, you know, you got to look really close to actually know that there's technology in there. So yay for progress, because we've been wanting that out of smart glasses. But that is one of the downsides, is that there might be glasses that do have the technology that are capable of recording, and that you can walk into a bathroom and someone doesn't automatically know that that's a camera the way they would if I was walking into a bathroom like this. Yep. And the social rules would bust me on that and tell me not to do that, and I would respond. If the glasses don't clue anyone into anything like that, well, bad things will happen inevitably.
Yeah, there are billions of smartphones with cameras. There are new cameras popping up everywhere. If you're Lauren Boebert and you go to the musical theater, there's going to be a camera on you. You know, there's cameras everywhere, not the bathroom, one hopes. But, you know, Jeff's point, like people could bring their cameras into the bathrooms and they don't. Like, I've never seen it, like anybody taking pictures in a public restroom. It's just not acceptable socially, right? So, you know, I think we'll figure it out. But one way or the other, there's no escaping the reality that the number of cameras will keep growing. The places that they'll be installed will keep growing. They'll be on people's persons. You know, there'll be lapel cams. There'll be, hat cameras exist. The glasses, there are going to be cameras everywhere all the time. And so we're going to have to learn to deal with it. In the meantime, I think it's really interesting that we basically have a new medium in the form of the Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses, which is glasses that live stream and have two-way communication between the live stream and the audience of a live stream. I think that's really interesting culturally. I could be wrong about that, and I could be wrong. Like, I think these would be pretty popular, and I could be wrong about that, but I think they're going to be Instagram influencers that are going to be all over this. And
It also doesn't sound like anything new, though.
What I like about it is that it's a form of live streaming that isn't, hey, look at me. It's like, hey, look what I see. Look what I'm experiencing. Hey, look, it's kind of an old fashioned idea, right? Because we used to take pictures of just what we saw, and now we take pictures of TV. Ourselves.
Just in TV. You know? That's the first thing that I thought of. And like I said, I don't see that being a bit of a culture shock, because I think people would still do that today if the equipment was easy for them to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole genre of this on Twitch of people with the backpack cameras.
You know what I mean? There you go. Yeah,
so that's a whole genre already. Mm. It'll just make it a lot easier.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, Justin TV. I remember that era.
Hey, I think we were working together at CNET at the time.
That's right. I think he even came in for an interview, and I remember him walking to the studio, and, you know, of course he was live streaming the whole thing, and he had his whole cyborg rig on.
And everyone was like, what's anyone want this for?
Totally. And now everybody apparently can, everybody's an influencer. We've all got reason to use this. I mean, is the, like we know the story pretty well of Google Glass, and, you know, Google, I think I would say Google kind of was a little too far ahead of the curve, right? Like, it just, they had to make the mistakes so that others could succeed is my take on the Google Glass thing. What about Spectacles by Snap? Because that was kind of like the...
Yeah, that didn't work so well.
Yeah, but I mean...
Well, those are...
They've had multiple generations.
Extremely weird looking.
Yeah, they are weird looking. They kind of leaned into the weird looking thing, and then that worked for a while and then stopped working. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to see if this works for Meta, I guess, is my point. Because I remember when the spectacles happened, and it was like, well, maybe Snap's onto something. Maybe, you know, Google took the lumps so that Snap could succeed. And now it's just like a, you know, it seems like it's more a toy than anything. And curious to see if that's the direction that it goes for Meta, or if Meta is actually able to kind of turn into something more. So interesting stuff there. We haven't even talked about antitrust. Do we want to talk about antitrust litigation?
Well, yeah, because I'm going to be my usual contrarian self here. I think this is going to really hurt us as customers. I think it's going to hurt the marketplace. Amazon Lena Khan, once again, I'm sorry, I know I get in trouble in the show when I criticize Lena Khan, but this is a prime example where she's not looking at things that have hurt consumers, number one. Number two, in the marketplace, all kinds of stores were able to start because of what Amazon does. It shares its marketing, it shares its technology, it shares its back end, it shares its delivery more and more, and it makes all kinds of businesses possible with more choice than we've ever had at lower prices because there's more competition. And this is just big bad tech company. And full disclosure is I have some Amazon stock, but I've had it for a long time. God knows how low it is today because of this, you know.
I think it dropped like 5%. I don't think you're hurting bad.
It's just, so I put up something called Five Arguments Against the FTC's Amazon case, which came from the CCIA, which is one of those trade associations for the tech industry. So you know what they're going to say. But breaking Amazon Prime is really going to hurt customers who love it. They're protecting competitors against protecting consumers.
I think that's an important point.
Break Amazon's logistics and fulfillment services, which breaks the marketplace for all these third-party sellers, which creates more competition. And then the other part of this, too, is, okay, monopoly in what? This is what Benedict Evans is so great about. He constantly looks at the numbers and says, okay, in retail, Amazon is in no way a monopoly. No. It has a tiny share of overall retail. In online retail, no, even there, because you've got tons of players now, Shopify, Walmart, Target, others.
Yeah.
So they made this on superstore online. Well, that's a stupid category to claim a monopoly on Amazon's part.
What does that even mean? Well, like a store that sells all things, which, I mean, I guess Amazon does.
They made it as narrow as like, well, Amazon's a monopoly because there's only Amazon. It was tautological, right? And so... I think Lena Khan's done it again, and I hope and don't think this is going to succeed in court for the protection of consumers, which is what her job should be. End of rant. See if you guys disagree.
The real issue is monopsony, not monopoly, and that means when Amazon has a stranglehold on sellers, right, and can basically tell them what to do, and it basically they do really push the sellers around. They drive all kinds of weird practices among sellers, and that's another issue. But like all these antitrust things, they're usually like a decade too late, right? So I think, you know, if you were to do this 10 years ago, I think it would have been a different thing altogether. But nobody did anything 10 years ago, and now sort of Amazon is kind of they're losing their sort of special status as everybody else gets their act together and people start to diversify where they buy things and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know. I agree with you, Jeff. I think that despite some of the objectionable news we get about Amazon now and then, I think just going in there with a sledgehammer and smashing it up into little pieces isn't going
to help
people improve anything.
Ant, what do you think?
I used to hate hearing people talk about how Amazon is ruining small businesses and so forth, and I totally disagreed with that. If you were going to say something along those lines, maybe Walmart, as Walmart comes in physically to a location and opens up doors with cash registers and point of sales or what have you, can tell people, what do they call it? Low prices every day, or whatever their slogan was, just something generic like that, and literally got people from mom and pop store right next door to it to go to Walmart. Where Amazon, if you want to put your stuff in their space, they allow you to put your stuff in their space for a small fee. Heck, I shop for camera gear on Amazon. I also shop for camera gear on Adorama.com, as I'm an affiliate with both of these places, now that I think about it. But I can pull up something on Amazon that ends up coming from Adorama.com.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, here's the other irony right now. So the other big antitrust cases we've talked about the last couple of weeks is Google and advertising, which is a legitimate issue to investigate, I will say. However, the interesting thing, but the interesting thing here is that Amazon is cutting into Google's advertising business seriously. And so, you know, to claim that Google has an impenetrable monopoly when Amazon is coming in, cutting into Google's ad business, at the same time they're claiming that Amazon has an impenetrable monopoly when you've got Shopify out there and lots of other companies enabling online commerce. It's show off time.
Yeah, one of the things that they're addressing is Amazon's activities against sellers who do things off of Amazon. So, for example, the one of the allegations is that if a seller tries to sell a product lower outside of Amazon than they do on Amazon, then they sort of tweak them in the listings. And when you go searching for a product category, the person who's selling cheaper outside of Amazon comes way at the end of the listing. Stuff like
because,
that.
Well, but Mike, isn't that for the benefit of the consumer? So we get the lowest prices up high?
Well, it prevents lower prices from existing outside of Amazon is the idea, where it's actually and so the Amazon's basic relationship with shoppers, according to the allegation, is that if you're going to sell with different prices, Amazon has to be the lower price, because if it isn't, we're gonna crush you on Amazon. You're not going to sell anything on Amazon. So it's kind of like again, this is an allegation, and it's the kind of thing they do. They also have this thing where we've all seen the, Amazon recommendation, the products you search for. Mm-hmm. You know, you're looking for USB-C cable. It's like, oh, this is Amazon recommended. And that recommendation is based on the company having exclusivity on Amazon, doing all this other stuff.
Those are issues to look into. Yes.
Yeah. And so I think that they should look into those issues. They should expose what's real and what's just an allegation. Breaking up the company, I mean, you're just going to have more Amazons, right? Yeah. I don't see what that would do to improve things.
Yeah. I think the point also that you made earlier, Jeff, about, you know, you got all these people, an insane amount of people buying into Amazon for their Prime experience. Yes. And, you know, removing that as an option is actually going to upset an insane amount of people. It's not like you're saving them from something, you know? It actually makes things a heck of a lot more complicated for them.
I started a community practice around commerce for media companies before the pandemic. And one data point that they all found is that if you had available for Prime on anything that the newspaper company was selling, huge difference in uptake. Huge difference. People love Prime.
Mm-hmm.
Invested in Prime. They want Prime. And, you know, why the hell not? The other interesting thing about this, though, is how long has it been since you got an Amazon package delivered? And this is, Mike, I don't know what happens internationally, but in the U.S., how long has it been since you've had an Amazon package delivered by anybody other than Amazon? Anymore or UPS anymore?
It's probably been a week, because I still get a mix of it. Actually,
you do. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
I still get a mix. Never.
Always Amazon delivery here.
USPS with the last, they get the last mile with the USPS on a lot of stuff too. So yeah, I still get a good mix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. My experience is I get a mix, but boy, you know, I continue to get a. Probably no less than one package a week delivered by Amazon. So it's no question, you know, our household, we buy a lot through Amazon. And I think at the heart of a lot of this is, you know, again, it goes back to fear. It's like, oh, well, wait a minute. If everyone's just getting everything through Amazon, then what are they not getting their things through? We've got to save those other places.
Save those other ones.
You know, from Amazon being... smart at how they do business and how they've done business, which kind of ties in with, you know, the Google case that you were talking about, where, you know, just was it today or yesterday that Eddie Q from Apple gave key witness testimony about the Google's deal with Apple to ensure that Google search is on the iPhone. And Q basically defended the deal, just saying, hey, look, you know, Google search, like, there was no valid alternative to the good quality product that Google offered. We wanted that on our phone. Yet that example is being pointed to as like, see, Google strong arming and charging Apple to ensure, you know, large amounts of money to ensure that their search is there. Well, hey, at the end of the day, like, if people enjoy, you know, and find the best success using the Google search, then don't like, that's not a reason to tell Google to stop doing its business. Like, exactly. People want it.
I always thought that that deal between Google and Apple was a case of Apple fleecing Google.
Yeah.
Google,
oh, right? It's just, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Oh, you want, yeah, we'd love to have your search, but if you want it on there, you're going to have to pay for it.
Most apps don't have to pay billions to be in the App Store.
Yes, fair. Well, very true.
Because it's also, Mike, you're absolutely right, but it's also a way, I mean, when Google pays Wikipedia, and Google pays Firefox, it's also a way to forestall this exact kind of criticism. Okay, we're going to share, we're benefiting from this, and we're going to share some back with you.
Right.
It's, I mean, I don't want to seem like I'm defending the companies. I don't want to seem like I'm against regulation. We need regulation in a lot of ways, but I hate stupid regulation. And this just strikes me that way.
Mm-hmm. Yep. To and, some
you
extent,
you want to regulate stuff? Regulate the phone company. Regulate my cable company. Regulate lots of things to regulate. But I'm not seeing that. And fine, look into Google and advertising. That's they own too much of that market. I agree with all that. But in these cases, they're just not looking out for the consumers.
Right.
Interesting. All right. Let's take a break. And thank the sponsor of this episode of Twig. And then when we get back, I mean, we've got so much more. The this week in AI block is enormous, and I doubt we're going to talk about all that stuff, but we've got time to do so. So we'll certainly do our best to get through it and talk about all that stuff. But before we get there, let's take a break. Thank the sponsor of this episode. That is Bitwarden. Love Bitwarden. I have it installed on all my devices. I've got my whole family moved over to Bitwarden. Bitwarden's great. It's the only open source cross-platform password manager anywhere, anytime. Even Twit, you know, here at Twit Security Now's Steve Gibson, he's switched over and he's a fan. With Bitwarden, all of the data in your vault is end-to-end encrypted. And that's not just your passwords, everything end-to-end encrypted. In the summer 2023 G2 Enterprise Grid report, they solidified their position as the highest performing password manager for the enterprise. And that's a big deal. Bitwarden making waves right now. Bitwarden protects your data and privacy by adding strong, randomly generated passwords for every account. You can actually take that even further. You can use their username generator. You can create unique usernames for each account or use any of the 5 integrated email alias services. So it's kind of like a suite around keeping you protected. Transparently view all of Bitwarden's code available on GitHub. So that's a nice bonus. So you can trust what you see there. On top of being public to the world, Bitwarden has professional third-party audits. Those are performed yearly. The results actually get published on their website, so you can read about it. You can go there and check it out for yourself. Bitwarden is open source security that you can trust because you can use your eyeballs to verify. Share private data securely with coworkers. You can do that across departments or even the entire company with fully customizable and adaptive plans. Bitwarden's Teams organization option is $3 per month per user. They also have an enterprise organization plan. That's just $5 per month per user. And if you're just an individual user, you can always get Bitwarden's basic free account for unlimited passwords. And that's right, free. And then from there, if you decide you want to upgrade anytime to a premium account, that's less than $1 a month. You can do it what I did in the Howell household. I brought the whole family with their family organization option, give up to 6 users premium features, only $3.33 a month. I mean, that's it right there. I was like, really? That's all I got to pay? $3.33 a month. And everybody is protected. Bitwarden just released a new passwordless SSO feature. SSO with trusted devices lets users log into Bitwarden and decrypt their vault after using SSO on a registered trusted device. So there's no master password needed. This new solution makes it even easier for enterprise users to stay safe and secure when they're using Bitwarden. And you can learn more about SSO with trusted devices at bitwarden.com/twit. Now, here at Twit, we are fans of password managers. You've heard us go on and on about these things forever. That's because they work, they're secure, They're just important to keeping you protected online. Get started with Bitwarden's free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. Go there. You can go to the website, or you can go to the website with that slash twit at the end and let them know you heard about it through this podcast. That's bitwarden.com/twit. That's the preferred way. Go there, and we thank you for doing that. And we thank Bitwarden for their support of This Week in Google. Okay, where to from here? Before we get into the AI block, I feel like there was something in this top area that FCC announcing plans to reinstate net neutrality. What was old is new again. It's basically the end of the Ajit Pai anti-net neutrality era. Good news? I mean, obviously it's good news, right? How important is this, I guess, is the big question. What do y'all think?
I just shot across the bow of the phone companies. Now that there's a full FCC, they can do this. And so it's kind of, we're going to keep doing this, and so stop trying.
Yeah.
I think it's fine. It's not earth shattering, but I think it's fine.
Yeah. Nice. I mean, if things felt kind of earth shattering when suddenly Ajit Pai was making all these declarations and cuts and everything, it felt like a really big deal back then. So it's nice to know that maybe we've, at least for now, maybe we've seen the end of that.
I hope it's settled. I hope we don't go back and forth every time.
Yeah.
Another administration.
That's kind of what I'm alluding to a little bit there. I'm like, how long does this stick around? Cross our fingers and see. And then do we want to talk about X at all? Disabling a feature. Users can no longer report election misinformation. Oh.
Well, there's also we might talk about that. We also might talk about the fact that Elon Musk has floated the idea of charging every user a small amount to combat bots.
Yeah.
Which I think is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, because like, what percentage of Twitter users are going to give their credit card information to Elon Musk?
Yeah.
That's fine. If he wants to die on that sword, have at it, dude. Just watch your product just burn if you want to. You know, you paid for it. You can do what you want. And someone mentioned to me in one of these social platforms that, you know, yes, he paid for this product and he can do whatever he wants to do, you know, or he can, quote, do the right thing. And sometimes, it's nice to be able to do the right thing, quote unquote. But again, at the end of the day, this is his product and, you know, he's got the rules on it.
Yep.
Yes. We'll see where that leads. I'm guessing not good places.
I mean, Twitter's still X is dying, and it seems to me that one of its important roles was a place where all the journalists went, and I think that that's the main thing that made Twitter indispensable. So where are the journalists all going?
Yeah, where now, are they own, now? Yeah,
my own take is that, at least especially in the tech journalist sphere, and to a lesser extent the political journalist sphere, it's Threads. Now, Threads has been being hammered recently for having lackluster user uptake, but it's basically nearly half of what Twitter is after just a few weeks. So I think it's not doing bad, but I think if you were to measure the percentage of journalists who are on Threads, I think we'd all be a little bit more impressed with Threads.
But I think more so because it comes off as a little less geekery and nerdery than the Mastodon, our friends, or Blue Sky.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Blue Sky's not geeky. I think it's good. You got to get an invite once.
Well, I remember, just once you got the invite, even the sign up was a bit confusing for some people, because you have the option of connecting your own public domain and so forth, and then there was some other server. I can't remember, but I remember laughing, thinking, "Yeah, this is dead." It should just be a click. Here's my account name that I want. Here's the password.
I'm seeing lots and lots more journalists there. I'm
yeah.
Blue Sky's my place now.
Yeah,
I love Mastodon. I'm going to stay on Mastodon, but it is.
Yeah.
Threads, I've stopped. I'm in fact, I just try to go back to it right now, and I can't get it to not pull up the damned app in Android.
Oh, really?
It's been so long, it doesn't even know how to launch.
When I go to it, it is what Twitter used to be with me and my personal experiences, the people that I actually follow now, because there's that tab. It's, you know, I'm going right there and it's people that I care to hear from and I'm seeing the content they're sharing. Now, if I go to that other tab, you know, the algorithmic base or what have you. Yeah, that can be a bit sketchy at times because, of course, you know, the filth will find its way into your clean space at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I never used Blue Sky. Have never used, what's the one that got renamed recently?
It's T2. Called Pebble, I think.
T2 now Pebble.
T2 is now that's called right. Pebble.
Never used that one.
And I like there's a slight redesign, which is really nice, and I like the name better. I just don't think it has a prayer to compete with the Fediverse or with Blue Sky or with Threads.
I think what I already make is that I think we're going to shift our sense of scale. And we think that Twitter was big. Well, it was never, A, it was never that big in total. And B, you never talked to all of Twitter. You only talked to a certain number of people. Yep. And you can talk to that same certain number of people on Threads, on Blue Sky, on Mastodon. And I think people will find those homes. And it's probably a healthier thing for the internet in that we don't have one place anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just makes the, it does. I think you're right. And I think as a user of these different platforms, and you know, I've got a whole folder filled with all the different icons and the different places I can go. It just makes for a more kind of like splintered, confusing experience. It's like, where do I want this thought to go? Which one do I want to kill the next 5 minutes of my life browsing through? It's, there were some benefits to having one place that I ever did anything through. Yeah. Even though I totally agree with you, Jeff.
And I, you know what I do, which is awful. I'm surprised people don't yell at me for it, is I'll take a given, I take, if I want to share something in the Washington Post, it has the Twitter button and it's always going to be Twitter. And I then, it brings up the link and it brings up what I want to say. I copy that. I do it in the Blue Sky, bring the card in. I put it in Mastodon. So yeah. In cases, if it's appropriate, I put it in LinkedIn. Once in a rare while, I put it in Facebook.
Yep.
And so I'm cross-posting.
Sounds like the rest of us creators and marketeers out there. Yep. So all we do.
Yeah. And I've seen criticism of that practice, and I wonder why. Like, what's the point of the criticism? And I think if somebody does that a lot and you follow somebody on multiple things, then pick one and you'll get
just
it.
Pick
you'll
one. Get yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, I think it's fine. I mean, I do the same thing. I'm thinking, well, it's kind of snarky, so it's got to go in Blue Sky, or it's like it's kind of a high-minded, highfalutin concept, so it's going to go on Substack Notes, and you know, also Mastodon is like it's always like Blue Sky and Mastodon or Threads and Mastodon, right? So I don't know if it's more of a personal thing. Maybe it goes on Facebook. If it's a beautiful picture, maybe it goes on Instagram. But I have no rhyme or reason for where I post. I'm just kind of like just it's all just a bunch of hip shots. And I just wish there was just some way. I miss Google Plus and I miss Twitter after Google Plus, where you just like go to that place, you post it, all your colleagues in the media would see it.
Right.
And interact. More importantly, they would interact with it and comment and stuff like that. But it's more frustrating. It's more time consuming. And I don't see it changing. I don't see anybody dominating anytime soon.
There was a time when it was all like this, though. Remember when Twitter used to have the post this to Facebook button, or the Facebook used to have post this to Twitter button? Like, you used to do this all the time. You used to post your stuff everywhere.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, it's true.
And like, I guess it feels like we're back to that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, sometimes it's hard to go back. It's hard to go backwards.
Thank goodness for buffer.com. I just do it all in one spot.
Buffer.com? What is that?
Buffer.com lets you post to multiple platforms at one time, and you schedule them out.
Oh, okay.
That's a paid service, though, right?
They have a free version, too.
Oh. Really?
And, you know, with the free version, you can set up, I think, 10 posts in a given hour, 10 at a time.
Oh, geez, that's nothing.
And And it's, right. Well, I mean, and you're scheduling it to go out to the social media platforms, you know, throughout the day.
Does it do Blue Sky? Does it do Mastodon?
No Blue Sky. It does have Mastodon. LinkedIn.
Does it still work with Twitter since the
still works APIs with X. Off? Still works with that.
It's Twitter. Yeah, it's Twitter.
And it's the place formerly known as Twitter.
I've heard people call it Twitter, like spelled like Twitter, but with an X instead of the T, and the X is an SH sound. So
the sh sound. Right.
Well, so you sound it out for yourself at home.
Is Masnik's doing X Twitter, EX hyphen Twitter?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at Buffer now. You can post to YouTube, Mastodon, Start page, TikTok, Google Business Profile, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter.
Meanwhile, I can't get into
LinkedIn, Pinterest, and Shopify. So if you want to post to those different platforms all together, you can. I like it because it lets me knock out my promotional stuff early in the day, and I don't have to think about it the rest of the day because I really don't have time to
sit
here and keep posting. I just don't. I got other stuff to do. Sorry.
Yeah, neither do I. It's why I hardly post on anything. It's too overwhelming to think about throughout the day. So a tool like that might actually be really
useful. But you're doing a lot of TikToks these days, aren't
you? Not really. I mean, I had said I'm gonna go and do some TikTok, use TikTok the way I use Twitter. But even that, like, I got to remember, like, my brain just doesn't remind me that, I need to post this thing. Something will happen and maybe it's worth sharing, or I don't know how you determine what's worth sharing, but instead I will move on to the next thing because life is crazy and busy and, all of it takes time. And I'm like, well, then why am I doing that? Like, I don't have the time for it. So when I have time, I do it, but... But it is fun. I will say, like, I've had fun kind of playing around with TikTok. It is nice to just kind of go on there and just belt out something and not have to like craft the words and, phrase check it, 10 million times until I'm perfectly happy with sending it out. I don't know. It's just a time suck. It's all a time suck for me.
Yep.
And sometimes I just don't have the time for it. So don't do it. Why don't we dive into the wonderful world of artificial intelligence? Because there's some really interesting stuff in here. I will just let you know in advance, we don't really have a Google changelog today. I did some searching. I'm sure that ScooterX has some links set aside. But when I looked at like the amount of stuff in This Week in AI, and we're kind of in the middle of the vortex of the Made by Google event, so there's not a whole lot of news announcements coming from Google. Some of them are in this AI section. So we need to
promote a certain club podcast called AI Inside.
Well, that's true. Mm-hmm. Jeff Jarvis and I do a podcast every week for Club Twit called AI Inside, where we talk about these things. Jeff won't be there tomorrow. So this is kind of like AI Inside meets This Week in
there
Google.
We go.
Sure.
AI Outside.
AI Outside of AI Inside. Yeah. That's it. But top of this block here, looks like the writer's strike is reaching an end. So yay. I don't know when we see the fruits of, the upcoming work that's about to hit everybody who's, who's been off for the last however many months. It's probably going to be quite a ways down the line. But the reason we're talking about it in the AI segment is because there's a lot of changes here, I think, that have to do with AI. So AI is not going to be able to write or rewrite certain material, AI-generated material, not able to be used as source material. The Writers Guild reserves the right to assert that exploitation of writers' material to train AI is prohibited. So a lot of changes, we knew kind of throughout this that, AI has been a big contentious point for writers, and everybody's trying to figure out like how big of a threat is this to what we what we do for a living and the living that we're able to make around writing for Hollywood. So, so some changes. Is it? I don't know. What are your thoughts on kind of where this got over all this time?
I'm glad they got to some type of middle ground on this, because again, I've said before that AI is not all evil, but AI is not all good either. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a middle ground, and right. both parties should be able to utilize it in the creative process, in my opinion. And I still think the artists, be it the writers or actors, whenever they get to their agreement, hopefully they get to their agreement soon, they all need to be paid accordingly and paid based on their body of work and their skill set that they bring to the table, and not get screwed out of a job.
Everything about it is very complex, and I agree with that. I mean, writers in Hollywood have always been, you know, if you compare the success of a movie with and the financial success of a movie with the amount that writers get paid for writing this script, mm-hmm. it's always been out of whack. Writers always. Have always gotten screwed compared always. To other players in the process. Actors get paid way too much. Writers get paid way too little. This has been going on since the beginning of time. However, this is just the latest chapter in an ongoing saga of how technology is changing the movies. For example, they've been using CGI for many, many years. This has replaced all kinds of professions like set design, costume design. All these kinds of things have just been replaced with digital tools and digital creators. It's cut a lot of jobs. It goes on and on. The technology is always affecting the movies, and we don't really know where that's going. We've all settled on the idea that you want to make a big superhero movie. You know, it's all green screen, and all the sets and all the machinery and all the vehicles and all the spaceships and everything is computer generated, and we all accept that. But you know, that costs a lot of lives, a lot of livelihoods over the years of people who used to build all that stuff in a Hollywood studio. And nobody can say that it should have been prevented or banned, or that there should have been a contractual prohibition on using CGI in movies, because we wouldn't be where we are today. Mm-hmm. Having said that, and there are also aspects of the writer's strike that are pretty objectionable. For example, there were some language. I don't know where they're landing on the final outcome, but the part of the proposal was you have to have at least this many writers. You have to have at least, mm-hmm. I forgot what it was, but you need like at least 8 writers for every movie. Well, that's just baloney.
Yeah.
Right? That's baloney. Some movies should have one writer, like, right? Aaron Sorkin, right? Or 2 writers or whatever. Like, you shouldn't be prescribing the creative process like that. And so that bothers me a lot. So we'll see where they actually landed and get into the details of this thing. But I just hope that they haven't done anything too stupid. And I hope that the writers get paid and can't be robbed the way writers and even actors have been robbed in the past. So
I just think that the mass blockbuster economy is, if not over, 100 times harder. Streaming is not where it's going to end up, because it's still not a good business for people. People are going to entertain themselves and make their own stuff. The culture is bottom up now. So the change that we saw through this contract is one stage in a huge amount of change yet to come in the entertainment industry. Yeah. And I don't know where this is going to end. I can't possibly predict where this is going to end up. I'm glad there's a contract now. It'll last for a little while, but all of these issues are going to hit again. The pie of money to pass around isn't going to be big studios. It's going to be still YouTube and such.
Mm. Sorry, I want to reply real quick to something that Mike said about the – because I – speaking – disclaimer, I was formerly a part of the WGA. So when it comes to the writer minimums, that's more for television shows, because there is like a number of people you absolutely need to have to be able to write a television show through the series, through a season. And so I think that those protections are more about that. I just wanted to say that.
Okay. Okay. That's important.
And like films and like, yeah, films, I don't think it's touched by that. I think that's more about television.
Okay.
And makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Full seasons. Yeah.
Another thing that it looks like they're noting as kind of a win for writers is that... you know, wage increase, of course, but around high, quote, high budget subscription video on demand. So, you know, platforms like Netflix and streaming films, and says studios are going to have to provide the WGA with actual data. So the total number of hours streamed domestically and internationally of a self-produced high budget streaming program. So Netflix, Disney Plus, Amazon, other streamers won't be able to invent weird metrics or meaningless self-referential ratings to give to the Writers Guild. So more clarity, because so, you know, so much of this stuff was kind of shrouded behind the business models of these particular streaming platforms. I think, you know, that how that trickled down to how these writers
based
are
on
paid.
Our analytics, we owe you a monthly check of 2 cents per month.
Right. This is called Hollywood accounting. This has been going on for a very long time.
We lost money on the movie, and so sorry, you don't get paid.
Yeah, right. So interesting stuff there. You talked about this. You alluded to this earlier, Jeff, about Bard. I can't remember in the context of what. I think it was in our very first
Bard!
Story about
Bard. Did you say Bard?
That's right, about Bard and you not being able to use it. But maybe you don't want to, because some of your conversations with Bard apparently have been shared to Google for its search results pages.
They did say they weren't going to do that, right?
Yeah, they did say, like, oh, we're working to make that so that that's not happening anymore. Oops. But, you know, just want to say, like, keep that in mind. It's neat that Bard
integrates.
At some
point, how does Bard learn itself?
Don't do that.
They've got to be able to use the questions to understand what the users want without feeding it back to the users.
It had something to do with a share feature. So if you got your results, I think I probably don't understand this entirely, but you as a user, you get your results through Bard based on your own personal data, and you had the ability to share that somewhere. And in the process of sharing it, that data ended up getting fed into like the search kind of soup so that your results would be based on that. And Google says, well, wait a minute, that shouldn't be the case. You should be able to share it where you want it to share without that then feeding that data into the search soup, as I'm calling it. That's my understanding anyway. So, but yes, Google has said they're going to kind of tighten that up and make that not be a thing. So there's that. Let's see here. Meta putting AI chatbots everywhere. Didn't this already happen like however many years ago, where suddenly chatbots was the big thing? And I realize we're in the realm of AI chatbots now, not chatbots of the days of old. But this story just kind of gave me flashbacks. Like, oh, I remember when everybody was putting chatbots into their products, and yet here we are again. Apparently,
well, in the messaging products, but I think this is really kind of the story of the year, which is that we're getting chatbots literally everywhere. The number of third party products that use OpenAI's APIs, and you know, there's something like 15,000 LLMs out there now, and lots of companies are using them to create chatbots for everything. Started off with like tools where you could throw in a PDF and then you can have a conversation with the PDF. Mm-hmm. Now you can with the Google tools that they announced, and now the Meta tools. The number one buyer of AI companies is Apple, turns out, surprisingly. We started the year where almost nobody was having regular ongoing conversations with a large language model. Mm-hmm. And when we end the year on December 31st, this is going to be something almost everybody in professional setting will be doing almost every day, all the time, right? So this year is being transformational in the sense that AI chatbots are being put everywhere, into our browsers, into our software, into our office tools. And this is really a sea change in human culture. And this is the year it's happening. I mean, it's just really a big, big deal.
Yeah. Jason, to your point about history here, do you remember Smarter Child?
No.
Active Buddy.
That sounds familiar.
Back in 2000, friends of mine started this company called Active Buddy, and the Smarter Child was a first, and it was very crude, and it really wasn't that smart, but it was that user interface. It was that motif of, I'm going to talk to a machine and get answers to things.
Yeah.
For a second, I thought you said, Jason, do you remember your smarter child?
No, I don't at all.
They're both smart.
No, not that one. The other one.
Don't answer that in the mic, Mr. Howell.
I'm muted suddenly. I don't know what happened to my microphone. I'm going to go take a break. Well, you mentioned
that. Yeah, we've been messing around with that kind of stuff for many, many years. But the new large language models is entirely new.
Totally different. It's a user interface. You know, what interests me, Mike, is that I think that a conversational UI is going to just become much more common in all kinds of things. One of the things I put on the rundown, which is, I maybe put it there so that Jason and I can talk about it next week on the AI show, is now an AI that instead of you quizzing it, it quizzes you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just think that dialogic motif is going to become more common, sometimes to an irritating extent, where I just want to put in a word and get a response. I don't want to have to put in a sentence. I don't want a sentence back. Right. But I think we're going to see how that lands out.
I've said it before on this show, and I'll say it again. I think that the biggest impact with augmented reality glasses that we wear around town is going to be the AI. So when we're headed for a world where the glasses we're wearing have sensors and cameras, and they look at the world and they interpret what they see, and they have knowledge about what's happening, and then they take agency to tell you what you might like to know based on what you wanted to know in the past. And so, yes, we're going to have holographic data floating in space, but I think at the end of the day, that's going to be the less important aspect of it. The more important aspect are the sensors that will perceive the world, and then the AI that's going to decide what to chat with us about, what to ask us about, what to inform us about. And that's really, I think, going to be the transformational quality of augmented reality.
Yeah, I know that Leo has talked a lot about AI being kind of like a parlor trick. We're in the middle of the bubble. I don't see, you know, how is this any different from the passion that bubbled up around NFTs and the metaverse and everything like that. But there are some directions in which AI, like, it could fall on its face in a million different directions, but there's a few ways in which it shines, and I don't see it going anywhere. It's actually quite a few that I would put in that category. One that I definitely think is really compelling. I think this is awesome for allowing communication to reach as many people as possible, is this thing that Jeff, last week on AI Inside, you mentioned a service called, what was it called? What was it? It was HeyGen. That essentially in real time takes someone speaking. I'm here on a podcast speaking English. The entire show is us speaking in English. You could run, potentially, feasibly, you could run this podcast through a service like HeyGen, and it would translate the entire podcast into another language, which in and of itself we've seen translation before, but then it would mimic each of our voices and our kind of inflections and all that, so that it's my voice speaking Spanish, and technically, according to HeyGen, it also changes
the
video. It syncs
the mouth.
So it syncs your mouth, and you know, it doesn't look perfect, but it looks close enough, and I'm sure that's just going to improve.
It looks and sounds plausible, which is pretty amazing.
Absolutely.
The other thing that's going to happen related to that with augmented reality is that we're going to get, there's a big trend nowadays when people watch Netflix or some other TV show, they put on the subtitles, even if it's in the language that they already speak. So people have English language subtitles when they're watching an English language show for a variety of reasons. But we're going to get to a world where we're going to have subtitles all the time. We're having a conversation with somebody, we're going to see subtitles. If they happen to be speaking a different language, we'll get the subtitles in English and we'll understand what they say. And then when we talk to them, their glasses will say into their language what we're saying. And so this idea of, you know, at some point, the idea of foreign languages will become kind of irrelevant. And also people get older, they have hearing aids and stuff like that. Because if you're in a crowded, noisy place and trying to have a conversation, you can't quite make out what people are saying. The ability to have subtitles all the time is going to be kind of a very powerful thing for people who have trouble hearing what other people are saying. So it's kind of a cool thing, I think.
Yeah, it really
Mr.
is.
Mr. Howell.
Yeah.
Can you spell that? That service you said, Heygen,
Heygen. I think it might be Heygen.ai. I'm guessing, yeah, Heygen.ai. So, actually, we can kind of show a little sample of this, Benito. If you have the
from
doc,
last week we had a video.
From last week's episode on line 67, there is a video. It's a TikTok video, and this will give you a sense of what it's able to do. And then I'll give you the reason why I'm actually talking about it, because there is news that totally ties into this. But it's worth watching. If you're not watching the video version, you're just going to hear someone talking a bunch of different languages. But if you're watching the video version, understand that the video was recorded in English, and then it was turned into all of these other things, all of these other languages.
And as you watch this, it's going to go language to language to language.
Yeah, it's really impressive.
If we could hear it at all.
While making my voice sound the same and making sure my lips are moving in the right way. Está bien. He grabado todo este video en inglés y voy a hablar en 6 idiomas diferentes y distintos. Gli strumenti di traduzione cambieranno la televisione e i media, traduzindo automaticamente il contenuto di video para diferentes idiomas
de forma natural.
Nie musiałbyś polegać na napisach lub dubbingu,
które robią zręcznie. So, I mean, if you're watching the video, his mouth is moving to whatever language it's being translated. You're hearing his voice, but translated into these languages. I mean, he recorded this video fully in English, speaking to the camera. And yet, you know, this AI system is able to kind of do that translation. I don't know how much time it takes to process that and make it happen, but that's really impressive. And now the news this ties into is that both YouTube and Spotify are adding features like these into their products. YouTube made an announcement of some new features, but one of those new features is AI dubbing. It's a dubbing tool called Aloud. It'll be integrated into the YouTube studio environment and allows users to basically have a single click to get an AI-generated dub into another language. And I'm not certain if that's going to take their voice or if it's going to be a preset voice. That I don't know. But the ability to do that kind of, you know, live in real time, we've had, like, you know, the caption translations, and that's been really nice, you know, if it's in a language you don't understand or you can't follow, to have the caption translated for you. That's nice. But Spotify is going that extra step. They are rolling out a feature that will clone the podcaster's voice for language translation. And they're testing this out with some podcast, Dax Shepard, Lex Friedman. There's actually an example.
Not Lex Friedman.
Sorry, I don't even know who he is, but I know that that's a sample that they put into their article. So
he's a long-termism AI fanboy.
Okay.
The other thing that's interesting, right. I think we talked about this in the show last week, Jason, was the show called AI Inside.
Yes,
only
yes.
For that club is members.
The show title.
It's dubbing to movies and TV shows where this is most interesting to me.
Yeah.
Is that you rather than having this strange voice is now Homer Simpson in a different language, right?
Yes, right.
Now it becomes the voice that you're expecting at the timbre, in the language with the lips moving.
Yeah.
And I think was it you who said this or somebody?
I'm not.
You only wanted it was cooler to have the subtitle version and not the dub version. Dub versions may become more acceptable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I never wanted to do the dub version because it always felt artificial to me. Like, want to hear the original actors and actresses inflection. I want to hear their voice. I might not understand the words, but there's more of a passion there than there is some hired hand that comes in and to give you the English representation of what that person, you know, that was paid millions of dollars to play that part was actually doing, you know. So I'd rather read it and get as close to the original as possible. This could be a good replacement, but I don't know. I think it comes down to the quality of it. But I think with motion picture budgets, you know, if this exists on a consumer level for like a YouTube or a Spotify account, I imagine motion picture budgets would do this. I mean, and I have to expect that they would do it exceptionally well.
But isn't this just the equivalent of like copy pasting a book and putting it in Google Translate, which isn't like the best?
No, it isn't the best, but I mean, that video that we just played, like, yes, I totally agree.
But it does take the tone and timbre of the original speaker. That's what's different.
That was impressive.
And I mean, what we just saw,
just
like,
purely for the machine.
Granted, I don't speak any of those languages, so I don't know if I understood those languages, German, would I have listened good. To that and been like, oh, that still sounds pretty synthetic. To me, it sounded pretty spot on. But like, I don't speak those languages.
I see only two problems with this. One, the lost in translation problem.
Like, yes.
You know, right. That. Mm-hmm. And then two, like, I think more about other English stuff turning into other languages is what I'm afraid of, because like when you translate English into other languages, you have to take liberties with how those things are translated.
Totally.
And that's an art in itself.
Yeah.
That in
oh,
itself
yeah, you're
is
right.
Art
yeah.
So right. I don't know.
Yeah.
Good
could,
point.
Could go into bad directions. But still, the technology is
pretty
impressive.
But also the other thing is,
for YouTube videos and stuff, great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine if you did have control of the script.
Yeah.
Right. You didn't just use the machine translation. Yeah,
that's a good point. That's
used
a good point.
This for the voice, the tone, and the lips.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That alone is an improvement.
Wow. What is the native language for this movie? I don't even know anymore. I don't even know anymore.
I do want to see. You know what I really want? I want to do it. You know, just 5 minutes of this podcast in Portuguese.
Run it through Agen, see what happens.
I would love to I would love to hear our voices
right
in a language that we don't speak.
That would be great.
Or do it in German and I'll try to help see if it gets it right or wrong. I'm not very good at it, but I'll try.
What would it do when you say
Leichenschutzrecht?
Say it. I will say it.
Well,
what does it do when you come up with something that's untranslatable that Jews presume is necessary in its English version? Because I see that all the time in publications. I just wrote a piece for Stern in Germany about AI and journalism, and I had some kind of to feed the insatiable maw of the internet, and I thought, well, somebody's going to have to translate that.
Yes, right. What does that translate into? That's a good point.
So I went on to Twitter and I asked people, and they came up with a whole bunch of funny and good suggestions. And then the editor came in and said, "Oh, yeah, there was some good suggestions there." So they would take care of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Oh, I got like 5 notifications over here regarding something called OtterBot that Mr. Elgin may know.
Yeah. So Burke was telling me about that. I know what OtterBot is. I don't believe I ever installed it. Basically, it's a thing that goes to meetings for you and takes notes for you in meetings, and it thinks this is a meeting. And so if that's still showing up as
Otter.ai.
Oh, Otter.ai.
Killed. Yeah. So where are you seeing that, Ant?
In my Slack. There's messages to me.
Otter.ai. Well, yeah, Otter.ai. Yeah,
people do it, and I would be in the Zoom, and there's another user. I put another user in there as Otter, so people you know it's there.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And it will transcribe the entire conversation and summarize it for me and do other things.
Yeah,
I tried to hunt it down and kill it before the show, but I couldn't find it, and I've never installed it, so it wasn't an application. So I got to figure out where that thing is, and I need to kill it. But like I don't know what's going on there, but it's actually an interesting product. I just happen to never have installed it, as far as I know.
So wait, you've never installed Otter, but it's running on your machine? Am I misunderstanding?
Yeah, I don't think I did. I install Chrome extensions for various things.
It's a drive by
install. Using their API or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I really don't have any idea what's going on with this thing, but I was informed about it from Burke before the show, and I couldn't find it. So.
Yeah. Yeah, monitors. I mean, Google's doing some of this too with Meat, right? Meat now has AI in it that will kind of analyze the meeting and take minutes and
go to the meeting for you. Yep.
There you go. Meetings, maybe one day a thing of the past.
This is how we make, like, we think AI is going to make us irrelevant. We're going to make ourselves irrelevant. We're just not going to go to the meetings. We'll send our AI, all the AIs will make all the decisions, and
and it'll free us up to go to the beach. Sit by the beach. Earning 20%.
You missed that meeting. You missed that promotion.
Okay. There's some other stuff in here. I don't know that we need to talk about.
The one, if I may, Jason.
Yeah, just real quick, absolutely.
I have another contrarian opinion.
Yes.
So the Atlantic, line 75, put up a story about it's basically all the books that are in the collection of books that's been used to train lots of large language models.
Yes.
And this collection, books three or whatever it was called, has been around for some time. It's not terribly newsy in that case, but they put up a search engine to say, is your book in there?
Yeah. Well, this is a question that I had for you. Is your book in there, Jeff?
So lots of authors have come along and said, oh my God, I'm in there. This is horrible. I hate this. And I went in there. Yeah. My first two books are in there because the new ones are too new. And I, contrarian opinion, I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
I write things to get ideas out into public discourse. Mm-hmm. I would rather have an informed AI than an ignorant AI. I want my books to be in libraries, and I know it's a different model, but you know, people don't pay one, it's paid for once. And more than anything else, I would have been really miffed if they weren't in there. I feel so unimportant.
My Jeff was not good enough for AI.
Oh, right. Jeff, do they pay for it once? I don't think they're paying for these books.
I don't know if they're pirating them. Which is, that's going to be the main issue, Mike, is whether copy was obtained legally, defined legally, right? But once one is obtained, I mean, you know, can they borrow it from the library and use it? I don't see why they shouldn't. And so that'll be interesting to see where that goes.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
Information is not copyrightable and shouldn't be.
Amen.
The expression is, but the knowledge and the information is
in
not.
In an enlightened society, that would be important.
Yeah.
You could own information so that others aren't allowed to use it unless it's Men in Black.
Yes.
Alex Reisner is the author of that article, and I will be talking to him tomorrow on Tech News Weekly.
Nice.
We'll be chatting this. So,
all right. Well, I have my contrarian opinion tweeted. You can.
There we go. I love it.
I think I'm the only one. People are yelling at me about it, but
it's a very Jarvisonian opinion.
It is that.
But I mean, at the end of the day, Jeff, you are an author. You're a legitimate author of books. Your books are in there and you legitimately do not care for very valid reasons. So your contrarian opinion deserves to be out there. A lot of people are responding because they don't understand it.
So it keeps it somewhat alive because now you want to buy, of course, the latest book. The Gutenberg parenthesis. Sorry, I understand.
Yes.
Not in this database, as far as we know.
To me, the biggest problem is the way that it's, instead of just saying, well, here's some knowledge and draw some of that knowledge from two of Jeff's books, it'd be better if it was like a real writer who said, well, according to Jeff Jarvis in the book, blah, 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 quote, and that's how it should deal with that. That would be ideal, I think. You'd still get the information, but you'd also see where it's coming from. The problem with that is if 30 people express the same idea in 30 different books, you wouldn't want them all cited. But you know, pick one and cite the one. I'd love to see AI do what academics do, and that's they cite their sources.
Yeah, well, we're seeing some of that now. What was the Google's feature a couple of weeks ago with Bard, where you hit the G and it will go through your generated response, and it will, instead of you having to kind of search out the proof around some of the facts, I'll put those in air quotes, the facts that it gives you, it kind of does that for you, and it color codes the results to say, these are backed up by true results, these are not. Right. So the systems are getting tweaked to do that more, at least.
And I'll recommend the find.com site, PHIND.com, for the third time on the show, because what they do is they do a Google search. They take the top results, they run it through OpenAI, and they give you the story with a link to the source. So it's like, and then they at the bottom they show you all the basically the Google results with the links to the source. Yeah. And so this is a great, to me, this is better than Google.com, and it's better than OpenAI. It's because it combines them, and it's up to the second, up to the minute news results. Sources as well. It's not, you know, it's not the end of 2022 or whatever OpenAI is.
Right.
So I highly recommend it as an alternative search engine for people.
Interesting. I wasn't aware of this one. I'll have to play around with this. Cool stuff. Before we get into picks and stuff, is there any final story, any story that we have missed that you want to champion?
Well, for three married guys. On Getty? Go ahead. You go ahead, Ant.
You guys have thoughts on Getty Images and their now interest into generative AI space?
I'm surprised by the story. The story is that Getty is going to be doing generative AI using images in its vast database of photographs. I doubt that permission was in the contracts of the stock photographers, right? So it seems like a kind of an end run around that issue. A service like Getty of all mm-hmm. companies, you'd think would be on the up and up about using permissions and rights and so on of its own database of photographs.
The stuff that I had when Getty umpteen years ago, I pulled it umpteen years ago because I just wasn't happy with them. Something never felt right to them, felt right with me and them far as how they were paying. So I just pulled my stuff. And I don't ever recall, you know, a terms of service mentioning AI. But again, that was many, many years ago. But I do recall in the terms of service of Adobe saying, hey, can we use your stuff for training our AI? You can. It's a simple yes or no. You know, I don't know if that's been the case with people using Getty at this time. But Getty does mention in this TechCrunch article that they had they are putting some safeguards in place because of the whole copyright issues and so forth. But I thought it was funny. Because back when AI started to get hot again in the tech news space, you know, that was always a story was, okay, people are putting these images up of so-and-so celebrity and the watermark clearly says Getty Images.
Yeah, right.
Because, mm-hmm. you know, Getty says, I'm reading right here. Getty says that it's imposed safeguards to prevent its generative tool from being used for disinformation or misinformation or from replicating the style of living artists. For example, the tool won't let a customer create a photo of Joe Biden in front of the White House or a cat in the style of Andy Warhol.
Okay. I mean, that makes sense. I think, I think the question that I have is anybody who has their photography on the Getty Images site, like there was a certain contract that they agreed to as far as the rights of that. Are those rights entirely Getty's in order to do this with, you know, to feel like legally they can do that?
Don't know. And who knows? They may have sent out a warning to contributors to Getty. They may have sent out a new updated terms of services
could be,
you know.
Yeah.
Most tech companies do that. We've updated our privacy policy. We've updated our terms of service. You get that random email that nobody reads, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yes. Okay. Any last ones going?
Let's end on a tacky note.
Okay. I'm always a fan of that.
Four married men here. And I grew up in a time when we didn't have online dating, and online dating is very, very common now. And a lot of people I know, that's how they find their mates. God bless. Sure. They're happy and it's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tinder is going to do a $500 a month, I think it is, version to get to the best people. It just really sounds tacky and offensive in a way. The good dates.
What do they qualify? What does the best people mean?
Well, that's the thing. That's $500 a month.
VIP match.
Okay, well, so I can read guess a little bit about
because,
this.
Because
I read a little bit about this. And one of the perks for this, one of the things you get for paying $500 is that you can message people who you don't match with. And that's just a recipe for like driving all the way. Goodbye, all the women. Is, bye.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's not good. Pimple vision.
One thing that is a similar, so I imagine that Tinder has the same problem that Airbnb has, which is that you think that when you're using Airbnb to plan a trip, that they're trying to find you the best place to stay. But actually, that's easy to do. The hard thing is that you have, in a given neighborhood, you have one great place to stay and you have 10 horrible places to stay, and how do you get people into those horrible places? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the challenge of Airbnb. And I imagine that Tinder has a similar problem. So they probably, the good people are the people for whom 300 people swipe right on, right? And then you have the vast majority where nobody ever swipes right on them, right? So you have this great disparity in popularity, I guess, for lack of a better term, based on the profiles and so on. And so what they're trying to do is, hey, you know, we have way too much demand and not enough supply of certain users, and so let's charge.
To get access to the supply, to look at it,
the limited supply. Right. Something like that.
It's but kind again, of what I'm I guessing, went through during my entire youth. It was higher than
supply. All you need is $500 to get to those.
A month.
Wow.
Oh, Mike, there's a cat just came down.
Yeah. Where is he?
Oh, no. He's disappeared.
Yes.
There he goes. There he goes. Right behind you.
Yeah. Just so you know, Mike, the table's rattling a little bit. So.
Okay, sorry about that.
No, it's all good. It's all good. Cat problems. All right, so let's take a break, and then we will get into the picks of the week. Just real quick, want to let you know about Club Twit, because, you know, we just closed up an entire section, a huge segment of This Week in Google devoted to AI. And if you didn't hear us mention it earlier, we do have a Club Twit exclusive called AI Inside. Me, Jeff Jarvis, and we're kind of rotating through guests, interviews, explainers on certain topics around AI, picks, news. It's a lot of fun. We're having a blast. And you can only get it inside the club. It's twit.tv/clubtwit. It's $7 a month for the club. That gets you access to all of the shows that you're used to getting with no ads. So even, you know, This Week in Google, if you were a member of Club Twit, you'd get this episode. You wouldn't even be hearing this ad. This would be removed for you. You get access to our amazing Discord, which is just filled with other Club Twit members, of course. So many of the hosts and the guests that we have on our shows are active in the Discord, so you can actually chat directly with them during the live show, different topics and everything that we cover. You name it, we've got it in there. It's a ton of fun. And then you get access to members-only shows. So we have particular feeds exclusive to Club Twit members for shows that you can't get outside of the club, like AI Inside, like Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows. We got Home Theater Geek. So, got so many shows. Not to mention one-offs like AMAs. Ant, of course, manages so much of the awesome stuff happening inside the club. So we got Lou Maresca doing an AMA coming up this week.
Tomorrow, Fireside, as a matter of fact.
Tomorrow. So is that tomorrow morning? Mm-hmm. That would be Thursday, mm-hmm. September 28th.
Tomorrow morning.
Right, yep. On Fireside Chat.
Get your questions in.
That's right. Get some questions in, and we'll pull from those. We've got an escape room coming up, an escape room experience. Anyone who's been watching the network for a long time knows the last time we did an escape room, there was a very amazing moment where Leo was wearing a VR headset, and he was on the ground, and he was finished with it, and he went to put his hand on the table in front of him to help himself get up off the ground, but he didn't realize that the table was virtual and took a header right into the ground.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Amazing things happen when Twit does a escape room, so you might see something fun when we do it again here at the club. So it's twit.tv/clubtwit. $7 a month gets you access to all of those things. Not to mention, you're helping us directly when you do that. And this is a time where we could really use your help. So twit.tv/clubtwit. Be a Club Twit member. And we appreciate you. And we thank you for
thank you
considering that. Absolutely. All right, so we are at the picks portion of This Week in Google, and I don't know, Mike, let's start with you. What you got?
All right, well, I got a couple of picks. One of which is called Summary Cat. Summary Cat is a very simple tool. You basically copy the URL of a YouTube video, and you paste it into the Summary Cat page, summarycat.com. And it will give you a text summary of the video. Summarycat.com. That's all it does. So it can be like a 2-hour video, or in the case of this show, a 3.5-hour video. And it will just give you a paragraph about what was discussed and so on. And so it's kind of a useful tool that's very simple.
Yeah.
My other pick is a bit more fun. It's called Grape GPT, and it's for wine lovers. So what you basically do is it learns through interrogating you what your preferences are for wine. You like certain types of reds. You don't like Tempranillo. You're a cheapskate. You don't want to spend a lot of money, blah, 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 blah. And so you go into a restaurant and you literally take a picture of the wine menu and it tells you what to order. How cool is
that? Really?
Yeah.
Based on what it knows about your taste and like what you're eating.
Yes, and based on what it knows about all wines in existence. So it basically knows... It grabs the information from the wine menu and literally uses deep knowledge about every single individual wine.
Why don't you do that in the wine store?
I imagine you could do it. I haven't tried it there, but I was thinking about this, and this appealed to me because we went to a restaurant here in Marrakesh last night, and we were very familiar with Moroccan wines, and we wanted to order a Moroccan wine. There were several that were in areas not in the general wine country of Meknes here in Morocco. And, you know, I had to go through each and every one of them on Vivino, right, to type in the name of it and to get information, to get a rating, to get information about what the wines were all about. And it was arduous. I would have loved to have just taken a picture of the wine page of Moroccan wines and just have it tell me which ones to order. So this is like kind of a fun thing. Unfortunately, it's iOS only for now, and hopefully it'll be on Android at some point. But it is an app, and I think it's a good use of AI.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. That's really cool. Grape GPT.
Very cool.
Yeah, very neat.
And the URL is grapegpt.wine.
There we go. Excellent. Everybody check that out. Then it was that and summarycat.com. Jeff, stuff number. Aunt, what do you think?
I hope that back in the day you sold a lot of NFTs and pocketed all the money.
No, didn't sell a lot.
Dap, it was a Dap GM. I don't know. Some say here. Said that the peak of NFTs, the bull run, was running $2.8 billion in monthly trading volume in August 2021. Right now, $80 million in July 2023, 3% of the peak.
Good. Yeah,
great. Gary Vee probably pocketed a lot of money, but a lot of people are holding on to something right now that ain't worth penny stock.
Is that?
Hate to say I told you so, but yeah. I told you so, people.
I don't want to get myself into trouble. When I hear that, though, I think, do the influencers who really went whole hog on this and leaned right into this, did they know? Well, obviously, they didn't have any sort of knowledge to know what direction it was going to go. But I'm sure they're smart enough to see what a lot of other people saw, which was like, I don't know that this is going anywhere yet. They were whole hog in and they gained a lot of money. Like, there's just something icky that I feel about that. And I don't know whether.
I think so, too. I think they kind of cashed out.
I know.
Speaking of cashing out, so people will buy my book, I'm having a book event at the school on October 10. Like Jay Rosen from New York University and I will be in conversation about the Gutenberg parenthesis. If you look at my Twitter feed, you'll see it come by with Eventbrite. And you need to sign up. But if you're in New York or the area, please do sign up.
There you go.
Mike, I expect you to fly in from Marrakesh.
Yeah. I will do that. I will do that. Actually, I'm just going to use Bard. It's all in there.
Yeah. That's right.
That's great. And what do you got?
Again, I was struggling trying to find a pick of the week that would work for our This Week in Google audience, but I figured, you know what, just go with some stuff that I like.
Exactly.
Which is usually cameras, photography stuff or what have you. Blackmagic recently announced a new pocket cinema camera. Well, it's not really pocket anymore. It's just Blackmagic cinema camera, which is the same shape and fair size of the pocket cinema camera, but it's now a full frame 6K sensor. And it gives you 6K resolution as well as some other features. It does not have the ND filters integrated into it the way the Pocket Cinema 6K Pro does, which leads us to think that there's probably another model coming down the road. This is going to give you a great image quality, dual gain ISO, all for about $2,200 for it. So it's a really good deal for the image quality that comes out of this thing. The camera that I'm using now is a Pocket 6K. This is a Gen 1 Pocket 6K, and this thing is freaking beautiful. Considering you've commented on seeing the gray hairs in my beard quite easily, but it's not a full frame sensor. It's a Super 35 sensor. So, quite the upgrade that they've announced, and I'd like to get one day. I don't need it, but of course I'd like to have one.
Yeah.
Yep. And then lastly, I say check out Start a Villain. That is a book that I'm currently reading right now as part of my preparation for interviewing Mr. John Scalzi, the author of Start a Villain. This is his latest book. Just came out, I think it was last week. But I'm enjoying it so far. So check it out, Start a Villain. And if you want to check out the interview that I'm going to do with him, you need to be a member of Club Twit. So you know how that is.
So you know what to do.
Twit.tv/clubtwit.
There you go. I love the cover of that book, by the way. You know what it reminds me of?
What's that?
There is a service called Crown and Paw.
This is a little off topic. I know that service. I've used it. You mentioned it on the show.
You get a really good quality, a certain kind of shot of your pet, and then they have all of these different kind of like scenarios, like some of them are like Star Wars influenced, or some of them might be Renaissance or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they have artists that will take your photo and kind of put your pet into these roles and, you know, frame it big canvas or whatever. And I did it and I was really happy with it. And so that book just reminds me of that. It makes me realize we got a new puppy. So probably for Christmas, I'm going to have to get that for the family.
It's time.
It's time. Yeah. Anyways, a little off topic, but Start a Villain by John Scalzi. Get that ahead of the interview here coming up in the club. Real quick, I think my pick is just also like you, and something that I like, because the other day I was perusing the internet and came across a screaming deal on a used Korg MS-20 Mini synthesizer.
Dude.
And I wondered, Benito, if you were going to be TDing, because I knew you'd have thoughts on this. But essentially, for people who don't even have a clue what they're looking at right now, it's an analog synthesizer. It's a monophonic synthesizer, which basically means it can make one note at a time. Essentially, it would be polyphonic, would be multiple notes at once, but it's designed to do one note at a time. It was originally created back in 1978. It's just one of those synths that is just really kind of heralded as a classic. It's also, as you can see, it has on the right side, it has a whole kind of patch bay. It's a semi-modular design, which allows you to, you know, connect cables between those points and basically create a synth within a synth and get really creative as far as like the sounds that you're able to make it do, make it sound, you know, put out when you control it on the keyboard that you see there. And I've never had a synth like this before. I've definitely never had a modular synth of any kind. And it doesn't allow you to store any patches, which patches are essentially like presets. So I couldn't like hit a button and it would load up this sound. Like, you have to create everything from scratch. But I think the reason that I wanted to get it is because it's going to really kind of encourage me to go further down the exploration and experimentation route, as opposed to just pulling up things that I know already sound good.
It's called a rabbit hole, not a route.
Yeah, that's true. It probably is a rabbit hole. Actually, Benito has a whole wall full of modular synthesis at his house. So he could tell us probably better than I could about the rabbit hole. But
it is very much a deep rabbit hole. Yeah.
Now, do you you have this, the MS-20?
I don't have the MS-20. I have friends who have the MS-20, and it's, you know, it's a classic synth. So yeah, you really can't go wrong with that one.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a miniature version, so this is like a reissue. It's a little bit smaller. I think it's like 86% the size of the original, but the circuitry is the same. The form factor is the same.
And you got some modern stuff. You got USB now, yep, and stuff like that.
Yep. Yeah. So anyways, so I just ordered that yesterday. It was one of those things that I came across it online. I was like, I don't know if I have the money for it, but I'm going to go ahead and click buy now, and it's going to appear, and I'm not going to be able to undo that.
Jason, so, this is the problem with sitting in Leo's chair. You just buy things.
Yes, yes. I try not to do it very often, but every once in a while, something like this happens, and you know what? I guarantee you in 2 weeks, I'm going to be happy I made that split.
Forgiveness.
No, you're going to be sad because you're going to be spending another $5,000, $6,000 the week after that.
Oh, geez. No, that I definitely can't afford to do, but baby steps, Benito. But when I am ready to do that, I will be knocking so that you can point me in the right direction, because I am very jealous of your setup. You've got a lot of really cool stuff in your studio. So that is the Korg MS-20 mini synthesizer. And that is the end of this episode of This Week in Google. I have to say, today's show was so much fun. I'm so happy that I got to fill in for Leo and to hang out with 3, 4, 5 Johns in here as well. 5 amazing people to do this episode of This Week in Google. Mike Elgin, thank you so much for zooming in from Marrakesh.
It's my pleasure. And can I do a quick plug for gastronomic experiences? Because people may wonder why I'm always in places like this. Yes. And the reason is that we have these gastronomic experiences. My wife really runs it, and we do it in Morocco, here in Morocco. We do 3 in Europe, and we do 3 in Latin America. And so I'd invite anybody who loves food and loves travel and hates tourism, because we don't do tourism at all, to go to gastronomad.net. And what we do is we do a deep immersion into each culture, usually for a week. For Morocco, we do 2 weeks. And we do deep immersion. My wife knows the most brilliant chefs, the most brilliant cheese makers, the most brilliant winemakers. All these brilliant people are good friends of ours. And so we go into their homes. We have these like very intimate, wonderful, authentic experiences in all these places. And the next 3 are in Latin America. So Mexico City in November, Oaxaca in December, El Salvador, our first ever El Salvador experience in January. And so if you really want to do a travel experience that is life-changing and unlike tourism, anything you've ever experienced, check it out. You can sign up for our newsletter and we'll keep you posted on upcoming experiences. But for traveling foodies, I highly recommend it. So
Mike, I do await the California burger experience.
Well, we've actually been thinking one of the places that we could potentially do an experience is Sonoma County.
Yeah.
Where Petaluma is, for those of you who know, and because it's a food and wine wonderland.
Yes.
And so that could happen, and there could be burgers involved. There could be.
There's a very good Taco Bell there too. Yeah.
Really?
Wow. That's Jeff's own gastronomad experiences. Taco Bell and Chipotle.
When I left the San Francisco Examiner back in the day when it was a real newspaper, and I in those days we tended to have our own kind of farewell parties. So I rented out a Burger King in San Francisco, in the financial district.
Wow.
For my farewell party.
Wow.
And doing it up.
And if I may, Jason, trespass on your patience also, if I can plug Chatterbox.
Please. So
Chatterbox, hellochatterbox.com is my son's company, and it's a smart speaker like an Amazon Echo that, unlike the Echo, is totally private. And it's you build the smart speaker, then you program it to do anything. It can do everything that an Amazon Echo can do and much more. But you have to program each and every skill yourself through the simple skill builder called Chatterblocks. And so this is a great way to learn AI. This is a great way for kids to learn AI, 8 years and older, but it's also adults can do it. It's great for schools. It's mostly, my son Kevin mostly sells it into schools. Schools love it because it's the only smart speaker that's legal to be sold in a school because of the privacy. And so more and more schools are thinking about voice-based AI education. And this is the only smart speaker that's allowed because it's the only one that's totally private. So check it out at hellochatterbox.com. And thank you for letting me plug that.
Of course. I love that project. And yeah, I love everything you've got going on, Mike. I have to say, like I was telling you in the pre-show, but you've crafted a really wonderful life for yourself and your family. And every time you come on, I'm like, man, that's like life goals right there. To have that be your ongoing experience is just really commendable. And yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for being on today. Really appreciate doing
Thanks
the
for
show.
Inviting me.
Jeff, what do you want to leave people with?
Oh, well, of
what's
course.
Your thing? Your final thing, the Gutenberg
and
parenthesis
out now.
Oh, out now.
Book,
yeah. When did
magazine.
That come? When did that?
It comes out next week. I think next month.
Oh, okay. So that's magazine.
Good.
Two books.
Right on. Yeah. If people want to find magazine, is there a site or should they just go to Amazon?
If you just go to GutenbergParenthesis.com, you'll find links to both.
Okay. There you go. Jeff Jarvis, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I will miss you on the show on AI Inside tomorrow.
Sorry. I have to go you don't to need a to funders sorry. Event.
Yes, absolutely. You got other things, and that is quite all right. But I'll see you, I think, the next week. So look forward to that.
Yep.
And Pruitt, what do you want to leave people with? Is it antpruitt.com/prince?
Of course. And I also want to give one quick shout out because I get a lot of feedback every Thursday, coincidentally. And it's always a mix of bullcrap and people yelling at me and angry with me for whatever reason. And then there's always some supportive stuff in there too. And I got an email, believe it or not, from Ryan Kendall. And sir, I just want to say thank you for that email. It was quite awesome. Right up there with Mr. Joe Esposito and some snail mail that I got from him at the studio. So thank y'all for the continued support that I do see it, and I really do appreciate it.
Yeah.
Fans make it worthwhile.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Ant. Always a pleasure to get to do this show with you, sir, and occasionally to look behind me while I'm working and see you at your desk, which is very close to mine.
Yep.
As for me, well, I'm here at Twit tomorrow, twit.tv/TNW. I'm doing Tech News Weekly for everyone, and Michael won't be on, so I've got 3 interviews lined up, and I'll be doing a review of the Samsung Galaxy Tab 9 Plus, I think, is the order of those words. So I'll be reviewing that on the show. It's hard to keep them straight. There's so many of them. And then after that, I'll be doing an episode of AI Inside for the club. But if you're not a club member, you can still watch because we stream the recording of that show on the live stream. So twit.tv/live. Go there at 1 p.m. Pacific, and you'll get a kind of a sneak peek at the show as it's being recorded. You just won't be able to get to it after the fact unless you're a member of Club Twit. So there you go. This show is recorded live every Wednesday, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific, 2100 UTC. Usually Leo Laporte is sitting here in his Dr. Evil chair doing the show, as I believe he will be doing next Wednesday when he returns from Green Bay. So you can look forward to that. There will be a lot of Google to talk about then because it's the day of the Made by Google Pixel event. So I'm sure y'all will talk about new hardware and so much more. But thank you to everybody here in the studio. John, thank you, Benito, for making this show possible. Thanks to you for watching and listening each and every week and supporting us when you do that. We will see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye, everybody.
Hey, I know you're super busy, so I won't keep you long, but I wanted to tell you about a show here on the Twit Network called Tech News Weekly. You are a busy person, and during your week, you may want to learn about all the tech news that's fit to, well, say, not print, here on Twit. It's Tech News Weekly. Me, Micah Sargent, my co-host, Jason Howell. We talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news, and we love the opportunity to get to share those stories with you and let the people who wrote them or broke them share them as well. So I hope you check it out every Thursday right here on Twit.